Coming up on Boston Public Radio, students at prestigious schools like Harvard and Georgetown Law want exams postponed because of the time spent protesting grand jury decisions in New York and Ferguson. Should they get it, or should personal sacrifice be part of the deal? Then Kara Miller on innovations in at-home diagnosis of every ailment imaginable. Then a local lawyer joins us from Uruguay, where he greeted his client just released from Guantanamo. Michael Moan will tell us the story.
Rich Davey, the outgoing Secretary of Transportation, joins us. Folk legend Tom Rush. He'll not only tell us how he got his start at Cambridge Hootenanny Nights, remember that word? He's going to perform for us right here in Studio 3. Then we'll ask you about the etiquette of re-gifting at Christmas. And the Dungeon and Dragon guys will explain the links among Dungeon and Dragon, rock and roll, and religion. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Good morning, Jim.
Snowing.
I know. I noticed. We have big windows here in the studio.
We do. So some students at Harvard Law and other elite academic institutions are asking to have their final exams postponed because they've been spending their study time, they say, protesting injustice in the aftermath of the grand jury decisions and the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. Some also want exams postponed because they say they've been traumatized. By the way, they have many supporters in these demands. But there are a lot of ironies, I think you can say. They're protesting our failed justice system. Yet they want rules bent because they haven't had time to prepare for their finals. And also, if they don't realize that protest involves self-sacrifice, then maybe they haven't learned anything from the sacrifices that activists made from the civil rights movement to Stonewall to the Vietnam War. So we want to know where you are on this at 877-301-8970. Do these students deserve to have their exams postponed? Are they being overly coddled? Or is it overly callous to not encourage their protest by saying, sure, postpone the exams because of the time you've spent protesting? Our number is 877-301-8970. And we're talking about this because the point of it really does cut to the core of what protest is all about and what the consequences of protest should be. Let me tell you my quick 2 cents on this thing, Marjorie, is if it turns out that you want your exams postponed because you've spent so much time and energy protesting, I think the answer is, I'm sorry, no. You have chosen the protest. Many schools encourage the exercise of those rights. That's great. But as I say, there is a sacrifice. On the flip side, if there's actually trauma, and I'm sure some people have been traumatized by the horrors of what we've seen, if you're traumatized, that to me is a different story. But for the average kid, for lack of a better expression, who is simply saying, listen, I've been so busy protesting, I don't have time to study for my exams, get over it, I guess, is my position.
Yeah, well, this story is troubling to me on so many levels. First of all, they are students at Harvard Law School. Other students at Columbia and Georgetown, also elite law schools, they're at really smart people at really elite places, and they say that they're traumatized.
Well, some of them may be traumatized.
Well, if you're a black kid at one of these law schools and you have been mistreated at the hands of the cops, you wonder why your own, and many have, your own mistreatment or your friend's mistreatment or your brother's mistreatment is less traumatic than the treatment of people that you didn't even know, that unless they were
close.
Well,
maybe both are traumatic. I mean,
well, I guess so, but I mean, You're going to be a lawyer dealing with horrible cases, unless you're going to go, maybe you're going to go be a white shoe lawyer and do tax law or something like that.
Yeah, and your point is what?
But I think you got to toughen up a little bit because part of being a lawyer is dealing with the traumatic injustices that happen to people all the time, whether you're a prosecutor or a defense lawyer. And frankly, I hate to be cynical, but, you know, I think that maybe this is just an excuse to delay having to study for your tests.
Well, why don't we hear, are three Harvard Law students on why they're protesting, and at least, obviously, their argument as to why finals should be postponed.
There are some things that are more important than an exam. Give us a chance to actually do some real things that have legal implications for a moment. And then we can come back and study and finish our exams.
When the law does something so flagrantly ill, law students need to say something about it and do something about it.
As a future lawyer, I'm going to have to respect precedent. I think it's great precedent. I think examination should be postponed so people can better address this issue.
By the way, every single thing those three kids said, other than the postponement, I totally agree with. Uh-huh. There's some things more important than studying. When the law does something so flagrantly ill, we need to say something about it. I think it's great precedent that we protest. Yeah. And like other people who have protested things that matter to them, there are consequences. The consequences are you may have to stay up all night studying for the damn exam.
Well, the other thing is, are the undergraduates traumatized? I mean, are the undergraduates protesting?
Well, some of them maybe too. You don't know who's asking
business school traumatized?
Maybe they, I don't know.
Why are the law students are uniquely traumatized? And the other thing is, That drives me crazy about this. You know, as I said to you before the show, I mean, I've been a reporter for a long time in Boston covering absolutely horrible crimes and murders. I remember one time going into a fourth grade class and saying to kids, how many of you know someone who's been shot? And these are kids in Boston public schools. Everybody raises their hand.
I know that. I know
Everybody
that. I know
raises
that.
Their hand. You go to funerals, you know, of people that are killed outside elementary school. Quintessa Blackwell was killed outside an elementary school. And those kids in that elementary school, you know, just passing by her blood on the street.
Was he saying that they shouldn't be
expected to go in?
Yeah, but everybody
and
has different emotional makeup, Marjorie, and the fact that those kids worked through it.
These are 8 and 9 year olds. These are versus Harvard law students. I think that they have to grow a little bit of a spine over there at the Harvard Law.
This
School.
Is around the trauma issue. We both agree that if it turns out they're asking for a postponement based on the time spent protesting, they just have to suck it up and figure out how to take the exams.
I mean, if there may be Fine. People with, okay. with mental health issues that have a unique response to trauma and I can't deal with it because they have other issues going on, well, they can go into their individual dean.
And by the way, that's what you're fine with, and so am I, and that's what the school is arguing. The school is saying, and it will,
yeah, that's
will
fine.
Do it. Well, fine. That's
but
where
sort
I am
of a
too.
Blanket thing that we're too traumatized to take our tests. I mean,
877-301-8970. Also, don't know this person's name, and so there is a sense on the part of some people who I guess have not been involved in these sort of things in the past. There was a Harvard medical student, luckily I don't know her name, who I heard on the radio this morning, who was in part of a die-in that they did, which, mm-hmm. by the way, I respect, and I think it gets coverage.
I think it's great that people are protesting.
But her response as to why exams or something should be postponed there was that if we don't do this, who will? The implication is that if you're not at Harvard Medical School, then nobody is Okay, 877-301-8970. By the way, we don't. I want to be clear here. Speaking at least for myself, I think we're not making fun of the underlying protests. I think we both celebrate the fact that people are finally standing
wonderful.
Up and being heard on issues of injustice. But one has to. We both saw a preview the other night of the movie Selma.
Yes, we did.
About the march from Selma to Montgomery by Martin Luther King and hundreds, if not thousands, of other people who made huge sacrifices, including of their lives in some cases.
Do you remember the scene? And don't forget, Martin Luther King was, I think, 39 when he was assassinated.
He was 39.
And he was 26 years old when he got involved in all this, mm-hmm. all these protests in Montgomery, et cetera, when Rosa Parks sat in the bus boycott and all that after Rosa Parks sat down on the bus. I mean, people were firebombing his house. His wife would say to him, there are threats against our kids. Now, I'm not saying, I mean, listen, I am a chicken. I could never withstand that kind of threat against my life or certainly my kids' life. But, you know, the point was made over and over again. There's no gain. There's no change without putting something on the line. And I don't think exams rise to the level that these kids are, you know, trying to make it seem as though they should.
Before we get to the calls, we have a lot of Facebook postings. Elizabeth is one who disagrees with us. They are exercising their constitutional rights, probably practicing a lot of what they learned in school and applying it in real life situations. All of that is true. But she ends with, shouldn't we be reinforcing their citizen activism? We are by saying, go do it. Regardless of what your position is, we admire, respect, and encourage, you know, public discourse, public protest, that sort of thing. But you have to decide whether or not you're willing to accept consequences for your actions.
Well, it's also the double standard here.
What do you mean?
Like I just said, if the kids at Harvard Law School are too traumatized to take
their
exams.
Well, you don't have any idea what's happening at all other schools. The reason they're focusing on Harvard Law School is because it's the most famous.
Can I finish?
Yeah.
Then I think we should say that the children of Boston and inner city Philadelphia and inner city New York are too traumatized by the shootings and the gunfire they hear every night to pass the MCAS exam, or that they should all be given a pass and graduated from high school.
Well, by the way, in some some of those schools, Marjorie, the next day is they have grief counselors. They do say things like, if you can't
really
handle this,
Jim,
yes.
That's the suburbs.
What? No,
that's
it's not. Suburbs. It is not the suburbs.
Are you kidding?
It is not the suburbs
I believe
only.
It is the suburbs. The grief counselors are not going into the Boston schools like they should because they'd be in there every single day.
Let's go to Linda in Norwell. We'll start with you on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Linda.
Hey, how are you?
We're good. Thank you.
No, they should not be delayed. There's always going to be something that is coming up that's going to impact your studies, impact your life. I was a graduate student once upon a time, and doing research, my laboratory that one of my key laboratories I needed was closed down due to a move. And instead of asking for an extension, and this was crucial to the end of my degree, I sucked it up and stayed awake for 2 nights to finish that project once I could finally get
it. Did you feel put upon? I mean, was there a piece of you that shared the desire that these students do, where you did want your exams postponed, or was your attitude, as you said, you just sucked it up and knew you had to deal with it?
No, I had a full scholarship for that program. There was an expectation on me that I should be able to handle it.
Okay.
And it was fine. And also, they're asking the university to then take an official position on this issue.
By virtue of asking them to grant them a postponement, it's a de facto. Well, yeah, I guess that has some merit, too. Linda, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Patrick in Plymouth. What do you think, Patrick?
Hi, Patrick.
Hey, I think it's all accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I don't downplay the traumatization. I think that's completely legitimate. But it all comes down to accountability. They're asking the police officer to be accountable, yet they aren't accountable for protesting.
Hmm.
You know, I just feel like I remember. You know, if you don't remember where you were, September 11th, my mother was a pilot for American Airlines.
Oh my goodness!
We were in school and in school the next day. You know, and so that was very traumatizing as well. But yeah, I just think it's more privilege type stuff asking for a pass on this. You know.
Well, Patrick, we talk a lot about accountability on the show, so I have to say I am with you. Thank you for the call. It does seem to reflect a lack of understanding of the whole nature of standing up and being heard, and that there are consequences. I mean, one of the reasons, by the way, a lot of politicians in this country don't stand for anything except re-election, as the old saying goes, is because they don't want there to be consequences, and there are. When you take a stand, there's generally a price you have to pay, and that's, I think, part of the deal. Patrick, thanks so much for the call.
Art is drawing the line at a reasonable place. If a student was related to one of the victims here, that's fine. You know, if there was a family member involved, if there was someone
I'm sorry. I don't buy that. I mean, he's making the same case you are. There are some people who may be based upon their life experience or something who may legitimately have a psychologically hard time. Those people,
psychologically hard time about what? The two grand juries did not return indictments?
Maybe they live through things in their lives that cause them to have a reaction to what happened in Ferguson and seeing that video of Eric Garner that has traumatized them. And as you even agreed, in those cases, make an individual request and deal with
them. Then get a letter from their psychiatrist
or
their therapist.
But don't belittle. You're mocking. You don't know what's in people's heads.
I think the expectations we have of people living through trauma every single day are enormous. And these people, again, Harvard Law School.
Fine, but you don't know. How can you judge individuals and their state of mind? The place where I think we're on safer territory here is those who are complaining about exams purely because they spend so much time protesting, they don't have time to study for their exams. They just have to get over it. And if it turns out they fail an exam because they can't walk and chew gum at the same time, then they're going to have to take the course all over again.
Okay, let's go to Anthony in Braintree. Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Anthony.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm a student at UMass, and I attended the protests in the 4th. And I think that there might be some legitimacy to this argument about, you know, trauma and having to process that and everything. But as far as for students who, you know, simply feel like they don't have the time to study for exams because they attended these protests, I think that, you know, they're not fulfilling their responsibility as a student, you know. And I think that we need to be able to, you know, balance our time. That's part of being a student. I know students at UMass Boston in particular face, you know, majority of them are non-traditional students. Many have kids. Many have, you know, work full time. And, you know, that's part of what we find at UMass is trying to be able to balance all that. You know?
Yeah, great point.
You know, and I think, I know for me, you know, I work and, you know, I work two jobs and I, you know, go to school full time and I was able to balance everything. And I'm not saying that necessarily I have, you know, that I'm more equipped or anything like that. I just think that, you know, this is part of, you know, fulfilling your responsibility to being a student and, you know, being willing to sacrifice and fulfilling your responsibility as a civic citizen.
Anthony, beautifully said. That was really beautifully said. Thank you much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Okay, let's go to Megan from Whitman. What do you think, Megan?
Hi, Megan.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I don't think they should be postponed. I think I agree that there should be some protesting, and I think it could be maybe organized so they could squeeze it all in, or they could come up, you know, I'm just curious if they're doing anything else. I think the protesting is important visually and, you know, to keep people aware, but is there any kind of concrete work that they could say, oh, I was down at the State House or whatever, trying to make this impact and therefore couldn't study or whatever. But
well,
I agree with everyone so far. You got to be able to balance it all in.
Yeah, and in many ways also, Megan, I think, and this is what Marjorie and I were talking about this morning, in some ways it almost lessens the impact or the importance of your protest, of your statement, if you're not acknowledging that it does come with a cost, as you and everybody else has said. So, Megan, obviously we agree. And by the way, thank you for the call. We're not screening out anybody who disagrees. We read a Facebook posting who was on the other side, and if there are others, we'll get to you as well.
Well, Sue says, and I don't know if this is disagreement or not, but she says, why should anybody care if Harvard Law School postpones their exams? Because it's a great story. It's the front page of the Globe.
Well, it's not just Harvard Law. By the way, if this was an isolated thing, if it was Harvard Law School, what's her name,
also
Sue?
Columbia and
Georgetown. There are tons. I've read in other papers. There are tons of other schools where this is going on. If this was Harvard Law School alone, we wouldn't be talking about it. Sue, is that her name?
Yeah.
But this is, it's local, it's high profile, and it's one of many places where students have been very involved in protests post-Ferguson and Staten Island, and they're not alone in making this request.
Tom from Lowell says, these Harvard Law School graduates will rule this country in a few years. I am moving to North Korea.
Well, I don't think he's doing that anytime soon. Let's go to, other than Dennis Rodman, let's go to Sandra. You're in Bridgewater. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi there.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say, first of all, I am frustrated throughout the whole protesting shenanigans that have been going on, minus, of course, the peaceful protesters. I admire them for standing up for something that they believe in. But what frustrates me is, you know, the looting and the tipping cars and the fire started. So what I'm saying is, if we're going, or if Harvard is going to postpone the finals because they chose to protest, why don't we just bend the law for the people who vandalize owners of stores or they started fires? You know, if we're going to make an exception.
Well, but Sandra, two things. Let me say two things if I can, then you can continue. One, the people you're describing are the outliers. The vast majority of people who protest, they're not setting fires, turning over cars, looting. But number two, one is engaging in.
Not only have they been peaceful, but I think it has been very moving to see thousands of people standing silent in these moments of silence.
I agree with that.
It's so moving.
But the difference is one is in one set of people, the vast majority, are involved in peaceful protest, and others are involved in violent protests that can cause great damage to both property and to human life. The latter category that you're talking about, hopefully no one is arguing for a pass for those folks. But Sandra, thank you much for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. We're talking about the request of people from Harvard Law School students to schools all across the country that exams be postponed.
That's right.
Because of the time they spend protesting and in some cases arguing they've been traumatized.
Because they were diverted by trauma that they experienced from the Michael Brown and Eric Garner jury decisions. So that's our question to you guys. They need to toughen up or they deserve some time out. I'm going to keep talking about this on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. If you just tuned in, we're talking about Harvard Law students, and actually students at tons of universities around the country, who want exams postponed either because they say they spend so much time protesting, they haven't had time to prepare, or they say they're traumatized by grand jury decisions on the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. We're asking you, did they deserve a timeout? Actually, I said, do they deserve a timeout? I meant, do they deserve timeout, not a timeout? But I guess maybe that was one of those Freudian things.
Put them in the corner.
Or should they toughen up because as lawyers, they're going to see, at least these people are going to be lawyers, see a lot of injustice in their lifetimes. They're going to have to deal with this thing. And should they just realize that actions have consequences? And if their actions are exercising their First Amendment rights, which I hope we all encourage, even if we don't agree with them, particularly in a country that protests virtually nothing anymore, should they be expected to pay some sort of price? And in this case, maybe they're not going to be prepared for their exams. And Marjorie and I seem to think so be it. 877-301-8970.
And I have to say, we don't have one email, except for maybe Susie's. It's on the other side. Everybody seems to be thinking that they should take their exams. Rob suggests if they really want to do some protesting, what they should do and make a statement, they should put their careers on the line, drop out of the class of Harvard in terms of to protest the justice system they're all about to enter as soon as they get out of Harvard Law School. So,
yeah, part of this is anti-Harvard Law School animus. I mean,
well,
it is. I mean, let's face it. But, you know, in terms of the mindset of people who protest and whether or not they think they should get some sort of special deal, there have been a ton of demonstrations at Harvard Law School over the years. Here's one law student, shall remain unnamed for a moment. He's at a rally in 1990. He's introducing Harvard Law professor at the time, Derrick Bell. And at that time, Bell was protesting the lack of diversity at the law school. Listen to this student.
Now, how did this one man do all this? How's he accomplished all this? He hasn't done it simply by his good looks and easy charm. Although he has both in ample measure. He hasn't done it simply because of the excellence of his scholarship. Although his scholarship has opened up new vistas and new horizons. Open up your hearts and your minds to the words of Professor Derrick Bell.
Whatever happened to that kid, I wonder. It's really...
He was too traumatized to take his exams, Jim, and then he had to drop out.
That, of course, is the young president of the Harvard Law Review. That would be the future president of the United States in 1990, Barack Obama. That's actually great. And boy, does he sound exactly the same.
I know.
It's amazing.
It's unbelievable. Joel from Needham. What do you think, Joel?
Hello, Joel.
Hi. I don't know if you guys remember, but back in the 70s, early 70s, when the shootings happened in Kent State, I was at the University of Miami.
People were killed.
I remember colleges being shut down. We didn't have to take our finals. We were all told to just go home. And I know it only wasn't the University of Miami. There were other schools that also shut down because they were fearful that the anti-war demonstrations were going to spill out and tear up the school. So literally, even those of us who weren't involved in the demonstrations were just given a free ride. You got your grade, and that was it.
Well, before Kent State, also a lot of universities were closed during pieces of the Vietnam War and conflict in Cambodia. So that's happened. So is your point, since in some cases of national nightmare, there have been school closings initiated by the universities, then we should be giving the same deference to the desire of these students? Is that where you're going?
Well, I see that there's precedence. I don't necessarily agree with it, but there certainly is precedence. How can you say, you know, one 40 years ago, or one group of students could just walk away from finals and go out and protest? And here we're saying to these kids, you can't have the same.
You raise a very interesting question. Everybody has seen the images of that young girl on her knees, kneeling over the dead body at Kent State. And it is true, many universities shut it down after that.
But
what is the difference,
Marjorie? The difference,
Marjorie,
is that the universities decided to shut down the schools. And part of that was about fear of protesting. I remember there were students taking over president's offices and trying to get into administration buildings.
Well, maybe we should be criticizing the universities for not doing now what they did post-Kent State.
Well, I'm not sure that the universities of America should be shutting down at this juncture.
Well,
I mean, maybe
you remember
how
everybody said that the protesters were wrong and it was anti-American and all this, and it turned out the protesters were right? Well, maybe, just maybe, some of these people who are protesting and everybody's saying, you know, go away, maybe they have a point.
Well, by the way.
Oh, no. You must understand, Joel. I think the protesters are 150%
right. As do I.
I love the fact that they're out protesting. It was so heartening to see thousands and thousands and thousands of people take to the street. In terms of the justice system and the disparity between treating poor Americans and non-poor Americans and minorities and wealthy white people, there's no question that they're absolutely right. The difference is, to me, if you're going to go out and protest for a few days, you shouldn't be asked asking for a stay in your exams. And I think if you are legitimately traumatized because of these things, which kind of is hard for me to believe, given the fact that these kids have gotten into Harvard Law School.
It's not fair.
Okay,
no,
it's not fair. Well, if you are so traumatized,
everybody has a different reaction to different things based on their own experience.
And say that they have mental health issues that prevent their taking their exams.
Is it any skin up our back to give them the benefit of the doubt?
Well, but I don't think the message. We always talk about sending messages. I don't think that forget the trauma people for a moment. I don't mean forget, but putting them aside, those who are saying we spend so much time protesting or so much of our energy and our psychic energy protesting, we haven't had time to prepare. I don't want the message to be sent that you get some compensation for your voluntary decision to exercise your First Amendment rights. You exercise and you might get arrested, by the way. That's the price if you engage in civil protest. You might not do well in your exams. That's what I'm concerned about, Joel. They should do what they want. And by the way, even if I disagree with them, my view is they should absolutely be exercising these rights. But then the issue is, should they have to pay a price or do we have to coddle them? And I would say I'm an anti-coddler in this particular case. Joel, thank you. I hear you. You make a very interesting historical point. Thank you. And by the way, one of the great protest songs of all time written about Kent State is the song Ohio, written by Neil Young, which is just spectacular. If you haven't heard or too young to hear it, go to YouTube. It's fabulous.
We have an email from someone who claims to be a Harvard Law student. Derek says, law schools grant exam extensions for reasons way less traumatizing than black people murdered, such as stomach aches and headaches. And I don't think anybody's disagreeing. If you're sick, you can ask to have your exams postponed. If you get too nervous, you can get an extension. I guarantee if white women were being killed every 28 hours, there would be a greater sense of urgency. No one called in who's ever had their life in jeopardy or live in perpetual fear of being killed by police officers. I'm a Harvard Law student from Ferguson. If we drop out of law school, then who will we trust to fight for justice? If we fail law school exams, we continue to trust the system that is broken.
Is the person on the phone who's saying they're anonymous from Harvard Law School the same person who sent the email? Do we know? We'll get to – don't go away. We're going to get to you in a second.
Oh, it's I think
a Harvard
that may
law
be
student.
The same person.
We'll get to you in just a second. Let's go to Newton first where Maddie is there. Maddie, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you. So I just have a quick question and then I'll hang up.
Sure.
I wanted to know if they suspended the exam during the busing and the segregation. I was too young to remember. I wasn't in college at that time. Well, so there was a lot of turmoil, and I'm just curious.
I don't know.
Boy, you know, that is a great question. I don't know. I want to think that the busing happened at the beginning of the school year, but I could be wrong about that, Maddie. I don't know.
I don't know.
Maybe we can look it up.
Maddie, thank you, though. We'll try to get an answer.
I don't think they were starting busing in June, which is when the exams would have been taken, but I could be wrong.
By the way, before we get to Anonymous from Cambridge, Amy on Facebook says, where do you draw the line? This is almost like Marjorie here. Where do you draw the line with a sense of entitlement? Can I get some money from the government so I can pay a babysitter to watch my kids so I can go out and protest? I mean, I'm not there, by the way. I know she's being sarcastic. I'm not there in terms of ridicule of the, I celebrate these people. It's just, you can't ask for a special deal because you chose on your own to be heard, which is to be commended.
And your exception is if you have a mental health issue that caused you to be so traumatized by this,
yes,
you can't
function. Of course. I mean,
just like if you had the norovirus or some other dread disease that caused you to be able
to... Yeah, and by the way, if you had a psychological issue in advance of a test that had nothing to do with this, and the hope is your school would be accommodating if it's legitimate, and if this is legitimate, it should be accommodated. Let's go to Anonymous in Cambridge, who is a Harvard Law student, they say, who is from Ferguson. Hey, Anonymous, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you. What's up?
So here's the problem. I think that there's a perception that people, that the students are demanding a blanket request for all protesters, and that's simply not true. The students across the country are demanding extensions for people who are traumatized. Harvard Law's policy is that if you fit into one of these categories, you have to first talk with a counselor to even get this extension request.
Mm-hmm.
So that side of the statement is not even being talked about, which is extremely problematic. Second of all, like I mentioned in my email, there are people who get exam extensions for much less severe issues. People get headaches during exams or stomach aches. So if we aren't willing to talk about the actual process it's going to take for someone to even get approved for an exam extension, it's unfair for those demands to be attacked.
Well, that's Anonymous, can you hold? Don't go away. Anonymous, I want to read to you a soundbite we played a few minutes ago from one of your fellow Harvard Law School students, which I think, with all due respect, belies the notion that it's all about trauma, which, again, I'm much more sympathetic to. There are some things that are more important than an exam, this guy said. Give us a chance to do real things that have actual legal implications for a moment, and then we can come back and study and finish our exams. Everybody's giving you a chance. It's the First Amendment to do real things that have actual legal implications for a moment, but then study the best you can and do your exams. I mean, anonymous.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
Do you ever fear for your life? Have you ever feared for your life?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Because the police officer had pulled you over?
No, but I would never say this on the air were it not for the fact that since you asked, was discussing this with Marjorie the other day after we saw the movie Selma when I was part of a leadership group that led a march into.
Anonymous.
Do you want me to answer your question or do you want to talk over me?
Well, I don't want you to answer the question, but I'm just confused about the context. So go ahead, please continue.
Well, if you can stop being rude for a second, I will continue. I was part of a march with some northern kids who were legal services lawyers and paralegals in Tupelo, Mississippi, about 20-some years ago. And we were all talking about how tough we were and how we were there to support some young black lawyers in the program until we reached the end of the march, which was at the police station in Tupelo, which was surrounded by Klansmen with rifles and clubs. And this little arrogant kid from the north, me, was scared out of my you-know-what that I was not going to leave town alive, nor did I think we would leave town alive when we left the demonstration and the brakes were cut on our bus. So with all due respect, Anonymous, you are not the only person who has lived through those things. I'm not suggesting I have suffered more or less than anybody else, but don't make assumptions about others. Anonymous, thank you so much for the call. I want to say one more time,
what?
If there is an allegation, you and I have a small disagreement about trauma, that is fine. Make individual cases. But for those who are arguing, despite what Anonymous said, and some are arguing, we played the sound, that we spend so much time protesting, we're not ready for our exams. That is the price one pays in some cases for exercising their First Amendment rights.
Well, I'm going to go further than you. I think that if these grand jury non-indictments, and they were obviously very upsetting, and they show the unfairness of the grand jury system, they show the bias of the court system, they show a lot of things. If that kind of trauma incapacitates you and you were at Harvard Law School and you don't have some kind of mental health problem, I think maybe you got to reassess what
you're doing. Well, I couldn't disagree with you more.
We'll stand in disagreement.
A lot of people, as you know, and I know lots of people, you know lots of people who have suffered through pretty serious things in their lives and have taken them years to work through them.
That's right.
And have been wildly successful, confident people.
That's
but you don't get there overnight.
But the people were not in Harvard. The cops were not in Harvard Yard.
I know, but you don't know what happened in their lives. I mean, like this woman I just got in this little tiff with from Ferguson. I mean, there are people who've lived in settings. The implication of what she said is she has feared for her life. Well, if she's feared for her life.
A lot of us have feared for our lives.
I understand. And some people.
I don't think that's that unusual a situation.
Fine. But what I am saying is some people don't react with as much strength as you do. Some don't. And for those who don't, let's be accommodating and understanding. If it's real, accommodate it. If it's not real, then don't.
Okay.
Let's take one more quick one.
All right,
let's take
one more quick one. Let's go to Ed in Braintree. Hi, Ed.
Hello, Ed.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Thanks for my call. So I think we're missing the point of education. Students are there, and we want students to learn. And if we're going to measure them before they're done learning, then we're harming society. But if we postpone just for the purpose of allowing them to study and learn, and then we measure it afterwards, which is the postponing of the test, then we've accomplished a good society purpose.
Wait, give me that again. So are you saying they should be accommodated because it gives them the room to exercise their rights? Is that where you are?
Yeah, and then we are benefiting because they're learning more of what we wanted them to learn.
Well, I think we benefit even more if they realize that standing on principle sometimes exacts a price, and you have to be willing to confront that and not expect to get a special deal just because you've decided to stand up and be heard, which is an honorable thing, don't you think, Ed?
No, that's a whole separate issue. I agree with you, and they have paid prices. But the point of the education that we're taking a great human benefit, a thing for our society, and we're squashing it because of that principle you're trying to.
How are we squashing it?
Hold.
How are we squashing it?
Well, we're saying their education doesn't matter because they have taken and sacrificed something. And I'm saying education matters as much. Hang on to it. give them a little bit of time and allow them to learn.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more that education matters, but I guess my view, and I respect your opinion, Ed, thank you for the call, is you're going to have to figure out how one can accommodate both in one's life.
Yeah, I'm just looking through the emails again. I think that the Harvard Law students did not do well on our email list either. Anyway, we are moving on. We're going to talk to Kara Miller, host of Innovation Hub. She joins us for a whole new way of thinking about house calls. Do-it-yourself medicine is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Should have heard the conversation with me and Marjorie during the break. Welcome back to Boston Public
I
Radio.
I almost murdered him.
So the notion of self-medication is taking on
Jim.
A whole new meaning in the 21st century. The do-it-yourself test market expanded 20% this year as take-home kits for everything from colon and prostate cancer, HIV, are sharing pharmacy shelf space with pregnancy test kits, blood sugar monitors. Is this a good move in terms of, I don't know, saving costs, cutting out the middle person? Or do doctors traditionally handle these kinds of diagnostic tests for reason? And is 24/7 self-monitoring a really healthy thing or a potential nightmare? Here to answer all these questions, probably a few more, is Kara Miller. Kara, as you know, is host of Innovation Hub. Hi, Kara.
Hi. As I was saying to you before, just a little tonal shift, just a little transition here. You
That's
know,
right.
Self-diagnosis.
Self-diagnosis.
Yeah.
Our blood pressure, our rage, our out-of-control
Exactly.
Emotions.
Oh, my gosh. If we were diagnosing what's in this room right now,
exactly.
there would be a lot of indicators Mark that the doctor would want to take a look
it.
At.
Yeah. yeah.
So what happens? What is this deal? We're going to be able to, like, basically have little monitors on our arms and
yeah.
know all our symptoms?
So, okay. So we've got a few things going on, but this is really a radical shift. So a few things going on. So everybody's seen people, like, do you know people who have Fitbits, who wear fuel bands, who are monitoring, like, their steps?
Don't
Why
ask Coop, but the answer is yes,
me?
I know quite a few very well.
Do you
so
around
his ankle? No, I do not wear
okay.
it. I do
he has it on his ankle, so you can't
no,
see
I
it.
No, I do not. Go ahead. Yes, I do.
My husband had one for apparently Walktober at their office. I don't know. It was like tracking your steps. And he said he was second to last, so he kept wearing it into November because he said he had to make up for lost ground. Anyway, So we have all these people tracking things, but I think we're ready to move to the next step, the idea of being able to diagnose yourself.
Can I interrupt you for one
yes.
second? I have so
oh,
far done
gosh.
1,964 steps today. That is 26% of my goal. Do you see this?
Good job. You know,
Thank
when you took out
much.
Your phone, I thought you were like, I've
I'm
completely
call,
checked
no.
out. I don't care what you're saying.
How does your phone know how many steps you've taken?
It has one of the, what are those things, gyrometers or whatever they're
yeah,
called?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Essentially, you're it's imprecise, but essentially, when even unless it's off, every time there's an up and down sort of motion, it counts as a step. I have a certain number of steps as a goal every day. And so, yes, it's been
this
counting.
Is Marjorie.
I'm sorry.
This is Marjorie's naivete because Marjorie, your cell phone knows where you are at all time, which means your cell phone company does too. So they're tracking you at all times.
Yep.
So in some ways, Jim's phone is just – Jim, do you ever sit there and just like – you know, make your phone go back and forth with your arm just so you can, like, rack up steps at the end of the day. I'm
was,
just asking
honest
you.
To God, I would this no, but you know what I've done, and then we'll get back to you.
Okay.
This is a true story, which I did not tell Marjorie.
You put it in the washing
me.
Machine.
I was 150 steps short of 10,000 a couple of weeks ago. You know what I did?
What?
I walked around the living room for about 5 minutes.
Oh, but that's real.
To get to 10,000.
No, but that's real. There are people who, like, do things with their phone.
Just
so
to
that,
count up.
Yeah,
the,
so
yeah.
that it will
okay,
seem like you've gone further.
So go ahead.
But we're at this point where one drop of blood is going to diagnose all sorts of different things. So we're used to going to CVS. I'll give you an example. We're used to going to CVS or Walgreens and getting an at-home pregnancy test. Now, pregnancy is pretty important, but you don't have to go to your doctor to figure out whether you're pregnant, right? And we were all sort of bought into, okay, well, that's a test you can do at home. Well, I don't know if you know this, but a couple of years ago, the FDA approved a test where you could do a cheek swab and it will test whether you have AIDS in about 30 minutes. Yeah.
Wow.
Wait, you can do it yourself?
You got it. 30 minutes.
And how reliable is it?
Very reliable. Wow. Very. This year, they approved a colon cancer test, an at-home colon cancer test. We are just moving towards, instead of just the pregnancy test or just the sort of glucose strips being available at CVS, all sorts of things are going to be available. And maybe with one drop of blood, or, you know, it might be a urine test or whatever, you're going to be able to diagnose things about yourself that you, the flu, that you never thought possible.
Well,
you
know, that's really exciting, though.
It is
well, no,
kind
it's
of
not exciting.
Exciting.
It's not? I'll tell you what my concern is. If it's used with care, then I think it's fine. Well, probably fine. My concern is what I said when I was introducing you, Kara, is that, I don't know if it's the iWatch or whatever it is I was reading about a couple of months ago. Essentially, there are devices in the works or actually in practice, whether it's that drop of blood going into a machine that, what did I read?
Which
could
is
diagnose
great.
Up to 1,500 ailments.
As opposed to your whole thing.
Understood. But people essentially can get into this literally 24/7 self-diagnosis thing. I'm serious. Where
oh, but don't you think there are people who already are 24/7 self-diagnosing
yeah, but it's,
themselves?
But the easier it is to do that, in my view, the less healthy it is psychologically.
Well, I also think you could say that, look, we've all spent a lot of time in those stupid vinyl seats in waiting rooms waiting
well,
to get
true.
Big vials of blood drawn, and that's going to be something we don't have to do anymore. It's incredibly expensive to our healthcare system.
That's a very
it's
good
kind
point.
Of traumatic. We're moving from having big vials of blood for things to one pinprick that's going to detect 70 different
that's
diseases.
That's a
don't very, very big change.
If you do go in to get something.
Much cheaper, by the way.
When you sit there and you think, and they're putting like four different vials of
yes,
blood together.
All
why
the time.
Do they need all this blood?
And in fact, you don't. So there's a bunch of different things happening. So actually, the youngest self-made female billionaire
I
in
love
the United
this story.
States, the reason that she is a billionaire is because she's come up with these wellness clinics. They're rolling out 8,000 of them over the next few years. So the idea is wherever you live, they'll be within 5 miles of you. And actually, Walgreens has partnered with her. So it looks like they're probably going to be inside Walgreens.
This woman dropped out of school, Gatesian,
yeah.
at 19,
yeah.
and now
yeah.
she's a billionaire
Stanford,
at 30.
Yeah. She just had an idea, and this was the idea.
Good for her.
Yep. And she owns 50% of the company. She's a very,
good
very rich woman.
For
she's going to get a lot richer, probably. So anyway, they're going to have these things, and these little clinics inside Walgreens, you're going to go in. They're going to take a drop of your blood for a fraction of what it costs to take a whole vial of your blood. They're going to be able to detect all sorts of different
Does
diseases.
Anybody have an argument? Is there an argument against this? Not my concern about you get devices that allow you to test yourself for everything nonstop.
Can you imagine
what argument,
how you'll be hooked up
What
soon?
Argument is there against these wellness clinics and the Walgreens of the world?
I mean,
what?
I think there's the argument that when you empower people more, you detach them more from their doctors.
Mm.
And instead of, you know, I mean, how weird is it to figure out that you have colon cancer in your bathroom?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's very, it's a very big thing to know. It's very traumatic. It's very different from you finish the colonoscopy and the doctor says to you, okay, well, here, let me talk to you about here's the situation, here are the next steps, that kind of thing.
Right. That's a
now,
very important
it's
point.
Also true that a lot of people don't go in for colonoscopies because they're very scary things. And so you have more than 20 million people in the ages where
yes.
you were supposed to get colonoscopies that say, no way, I don't want a colonoscopy.
Yeah.
So there are bad and good here. And I definitely think doctors worry about sort of losing control
mm-hmm.
In good ways and bad ways of like that they are the point person on this. And when you are empowered to know all this stuff, what do you do when you find out you have the flu or you have AIDS or you have colon cancer? What do you do with that information?
Well, this is a great topic for our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan,
yes,
next
yes.
Wednesday when he's with us, because there really is an issue. Even, I mean, the cost issue is significant and important. Did we ever get to the story with him yesterday? Oh, we did, about how while millions of more people, because of the Affordable Care Act, are on Medicaid, and half of them can't find a doctor. Either a doctor won't make an appointment or is not even at that address. Obviously, that helps fill this hole. But then the issue you raise is a great issue about assuming that the results of a test are positive. Most of us don't have the ability to cope terribly well with those things and actually need somebody at that moment
right.
to be telling us what's real and what we can do.
Now, I will say that when this becomes normal and natural in what you do, it will become normal. I mean, we're all used to pregnancy tests. And many, many people have had a pregnancy either themselves or in their family. And when you find out that you're pregnant, you don't say, okay, well, I'm done here. You go in and you see your doctor, right?
But you know what I think is so funny about pregnancy tests, though, is that depending if you may want to be pregnant, you may not want
right.
to be pregnant. But I think one pregnancy test is never enough. If you get a result you're not happy with, then you're back to CVS or Walgreens. You bought like 7 or 8 pregnancy tests before you finally concede the point if you
right.
don't want it to be what you
right.
want it to be.
But that's become something that's so normal.
So normalized,
it seems like, of course, that's a major, major thing, that a major medical thing that you test at home. Well, soon I think we're going to think, oh, yeah, of course, everybody swabs their cheek to see if they have AIDS. Like, that's a normal thing. You don't have to go into a clinic and see a doctor for that. The next level of things, which is really interesting and actually, strangely, is not that far away, is, I don't know if you ever watched Star Trek, but they have this thing called the tricorder. And the tricorder detects all these things. It's this little sort of portable, it's like the size of a paperback book. And there's a guy around here, Dr. Eugene Chan, who's been working on this. I talked to him. He actually developed it for people in space. He developed it for NASA. And the reason is because when you're in space, obviously, you don't have a physician that you can go to, and you need to track all these things. So it can give you an at-home EKG. So there's all sorts of things at hospitals that are going to be transferred to the home.
Can I tell you, I'm not going to have time to prepare for the show.
Are you ready?
I am talking about myself.
EKG at home.
The danger. I'm going to be doing it every day. I mean, despite what Marjorie says, I'm not a hypochondriac.
Okay. You're not a hypochondriac.
No, I'm not. I'm not
no,
close.
You're not.
I'm not close
not
to being
close.
A hypochondriac.
Nope.
But I do. I mean, I am a little test crazed. It's from time.
How many MRIs have you had, Jim?
I've had a number, but for good reason. But I'm serious.
This is the problem with the healthcare system right here.
Exactly.
It really is. It's not a non-issue. The convenience, the cost, all that stuff is all pluses, I know. But there's something that maybe it's because it's just change. And obviously change is scary. And the comfort, assuming you've been lucky enough to find a doctor to begin with and then find one you trust, the comfort of that relationship – I wouldn't say is violated by this, but you know where I'm going with it.
Well, I do. And I do think that the pregnancy model is a good one because that diagnosis of, okay, you are pregnant is only the beginning of you seeing your doctor actually a ton. I mean, pregnancy means you actually have to see the doctor a lot more than you ever did when you weren't pregnant. So I do think that's like one model that we could look at. Dr. Chan made a couple of points to me about the idea of being able to like give yourself an EKG at home. One is he noted that there are a bunch of people who have things like strokes. He said he actually had a friend in this situation who eventually had a stroke. But if he had been able to monitor himself while he was relatively healthy, he would have been able to see that there were outlying, that there were outliers.
Wow.
And so we get into this position where people know they're going to likely have a heart attack, but they haven't had one yet, which in some ways is the best of all worlds, right? Where you know something's coming, but you don't actually have to have the heart attack because you're able to use a device that says, look, you're in danger zone. You know, we're monitoring you. You haven't had anything yet, but I'd get to a doctor right away.
I should know this, but I don't. An EKG measures your blood flowing through your veins and arteries. Is that what it does?
I think it measures your heart.
Oh, your heart.
Yeah.
Your heartbeat?
Electrocardiogram, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I don't get that. I don't understand that.
I have to say, I'm not a medical doctor, so.
You don't need to be anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't need to be.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know what's interesting? Yeah. We were talking about Art Kaplan a minute ago. Remember one of the things we talked about him yesterday? Is I know some people are offended when I call them shrinks, but I am a great admirer of shrinks.
Yes, you are.
Remember this whole discussion we had about getting psychological counseling via Skype?
Oh, yes.
I mean, the direction we're going. I mean, you self-diagnose here. You, as per Kara and her interviews, you then consult with the doctor via Skype. I mean, we were talking just about psychologists or psychiatrists, but obviously you could have the follow-up conversation with your – I mean, the potential for there to be a total non-physical relationship is great. I don't mean ever, but you really – That's what concerns me.
I mean,
the human contact element of healthcare is a pretty important thing to me.
So I actually don't think that. I mean, first of all, the cat's already out of the bag here. I mean,
no, I know,
mother and my grandmother all had flu shots at CVS. Right? Which is something you used to have to go into the doctor's office for. But I think you could argue in some ways that a doctor giving you a flu shot is a total waste of a doctor.
Yeah,
I mean,
they don't get trained
for like 8 years to figure out how to give you a flu shot.
Do you feel weird at all having the pharmacist? I love my pharmacist at Walgreens, but I love them. Do you feel weird having your pharmacist give you a flu shot?
I don't really.
Why do you feel weird?
I don't know. I mean, just what you're used to.
Maybe you could go to a different town.
No, it wasn't because. Okay, go ahead, Karen. I'm sorry.
But I mean, we've already, I think, moved away in some ways from having doctors do these menial things. which is good because right now I have a friend who's a primary care physician. She said she feels slammed. Like every day there's so many people, like 7 minutes each. And so if she could focus on the important stuff and not have to do like the little stuff that honestly a nurse could do or maybe a pharmacist could do. I mean, somebody who has some training, but you don't need to have done rounds and done time, you know, worked in an emergency room. You just don't need to have done that.
Well, I would
then
think
maybe they could spend, I don't know, like 14 minutes with you.
More and more healthcare should be done by physician's assistants, if you ask
me. Oh, totally right.
They can do so
much.
By
the way, you misunderstood or maybe I misspoke. I wasn't saying that everything's got to be done by a doctor. I meant the human contact, even if it is the pharmacist.
I totally agree.
Hey, can I ask, you may have said this, but let me be, this Dr. Eugene Chan, who you interviewed.
Yes.
They say that he created this portable handheld device you're talking about, diagnosed hundreds of diseases using a single drop of blood. Is that on the market?
So I believe it's being used by NASA. I'm not sure if it's commercially available, and it can only diagnose certain things now. HIV, it can check certain vitamin levels. He's working on adding to that one drop of blood, you know, different things that can analyze.
But this, its availability to real people is imminent. I mean, this is in
It's already being used by NASA and astronauts.
Most people are always stunned. I mean, I know we're all running around with our sunscreens now, so people have vitamin D deficiencies that you have no idea you have. Or a lot of people have the vitamin B6 or B12 deficiencies or something like that. I mean, there are all these vitamin deficiencies we're totally ignorant about.
Well, I also think, back to Jim's idea of, like, what's the downside of this? I think there is also a downside that people over-treat things, that they know every single thing that's wrong with them. Maybe something that, you know, maybe you're a little deficient in vitamin D, but it never really would affect your life.
Yep.
It's not something you need to take a pill for. And that people are sort of hyper aware of all these things and they feel like they have. There are definitely downsides to this, but I do think it's coming anyway just because the technology is here.
In a couple of weeks, I'm going to have a device strapped to every limb when I come
awesome.
Into the studio. So what are you doing tonight and Saturday?
So tonight.
Awesome, sure it is.
Yeah, well. I mean,
go ahead.
So tonight we're talking about how screens affect little kids and what it's doing to their brains. And then this Saturday, we talk about the self-diagnosis thing. And we actually talked to the guy. He was at Swarthmore College at the time who created the first blog, the first one.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that's pretty great.
And his friends were not happy when he started writing about sex and drugs and all that stuff.
Oh, tuning in for that one. Absolutely. Karen Miller is the host of Innovation Hub tonight at 9 and Saturday mornings at 10. Up next, the long legal haul that goes into representing a Guantanamo detainee and what it takes to get a client free. We're going to talk to a Boston lawyer who has done just that. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
A local lawyer, Michael Mohn, kicks off the noon hour. He joins us from Uruguay, where he greeted his client just released from Guantanamo. Michael Mohn will tell us the story.
Rich Davey, the outgoing transportation secretary, joins us. Folk legend, singer, songwriter Tom Rush will not only tell us about getting his start at Hootenanny Nights in Cambridge. Remember the word Hootenanny? He's going to perform for us right here in Studio 3. Then we'll ask you about the etiquette of re-gifting at Christmastron, and the Dungeon and Dragon guys will explain the link among Dungeon and Dragons, rock and roll, and religion. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So all week long, we've been talking about how interrogations, which use excessive force, do not yield valuable intelligence. One example of that is the fate of Ali Hussein Shaban. 13 years ago, he was detained when he tried to cross the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, shipped to Guantanamo, where another prisoner said that he was a terrorist, that Shaban was a trained suicide bomber who fought with Osama bin Laden. None of those claims turned out to be true. So after months of diplomatic wrangling between American and Uruguayan officials, six Guantanamo detainees were on a military transport plane to Montevideo. Ali Hussein Shaban is one of those free men. Joining us on the line from Montevideo is his lawyer, Michael Mohn. Michael practices civil litigation at Esdale, Barrett, Jacobs, and Mohn Law Firm in Boston. Michael, congratulations and welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you very much, Jim and Marjorie. I hope you can hear me. I'm a little hoarse from talking too much, I think.
No, well, we hear you well.
We can hear you very well. So, Michael, thank you for being here. You told the Globe a little while ago that you told your client really didn't believe this was going to happen, Shaban, until it happened. You told him, I'll see you on the other side. The whole thing was very emotional. You did greet him, I believe, when he got off the plane over there. What was that like?
You know, to watch the men walk down the gangplank one by one, it was very moving. There was a gentleman from the Uruguayan government who said that he had been in the army for 23 years and, you know, been with the police force. And he said it was the most moving thing he had ever seen. You know, and I'm just very happy and overwhelmed with gratitude. And I know my client is for what the Uruguayan government has done and what President Mujica has done. It's just staggering, and he's very lucky to have been resettled in such a country that has been so welcoming to him.
Well, let's work backwards. Tell people the story of Ali Shaban. What happened to him when he was 19?
So he graduated from high school. He was very smart, and he came from a big family outside of Damascus. And although, you know, family can be very supportive and nurturing, we all know that at times I think family can be a little suffocating. And I think when he got out of school, he really wanted to travel a bit and see a little bit of the world. And so, you know, he traveled through Turkey, and his plan was to go and travel for a bit before he eventually went back to university and went to Turkey, Iran, went to Afghanistan, you know, 15 months before September 11th, and was studying the Quran and doing some volunteer work and, you know, living there and met with some other Syrians. And then the war broke out, and he and many others were told by the locals in Kabul that you better get out of here, because when the Northern Alliance comes in, there will be reprisals, and it's not going to be safe for you. So he, like thousands of others, fled Kabul and headed towards the Pakistani border. When he was trying to cross the border, he and some others were detained by the Pakistani border guards. They called in the Americans. They were paid a bounty, and he was then taken to first to Kabul, then to Kandahar prison run by the U.S., and then in June of 2002, he was sent to Guantanamo. He was never charged with a crime, was never going to have a trial. He was cleared by the highest levels of the U.S. security, you know, by the Department of Justice, Department of Defense, State, Homeland Security, Joint Chiefs, cleared for release. And, you know, he's been waiting for the last 4 years, you know, for them to find him a home, because obviously even before the civil war broke out in Syria, it wasn't safe to be sent back to Syria. And certainly once the civil war broke out there, it obviously was not a place for him to go.
We're talking to Michael Mohn, who's the lawyer for Ali Hussein Shaban, just released from Guantanamo. Michael's talking to us from Uruguay, which is where Shaban now is. Who set this guy up, and why did he set him up?
The allegations that, you know, you can go online, you can see what's known as the Combatant Status Review Tribunal. Those were the kangaroo courts that were set up by Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld, where they, you know, read out these charges and read out these allegations, but provided the detainee with, you know, no basis, no evidence, no lawyer, and asked them to respond. It's ridiculous. You know, when and there were further periodic review boards, administrative review board sessions that they had. And so over time, the allegations shrunk and shrunk and shrunk until finally, 2 years ago, when they finally had to put forward and file their factual return, which was what they were willing to say in court and try and defend as the the evidence that provided the legal basis for holding him, the two allegations were allegations that were made from a well-known and now long discredited detainee at Guantanamo who has snitched on something like 250 other detainees, and even eventually the U.S. government placed no faith in his word and had to backtrack from all these allegations. That was the only thing that was left. They have no evidence of anything against him, and that's because he never did anything. He's innocent. He was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time, and sadly, he's not the only one. There were hundreds of men. We sent hundreds of men to Guantanamo who had no connection with terrorism.
Yeah, but Mike, Michael, I have to say, if I had a nickel for every time we've heard the following on the radio, as the old saying goes, I'd be a rich man. Well, wait a second. The United States government would not send someone to Guantanamo for all of their 20s, take him out of their life, allege that they're a terrorist if there wasn't something there. I mean, isn't that the mindset, unfortunately, of the vast majority of people who believe in due process in their own lives, but apparently don't believe in due process when it comes to Guantanamo?
You're exactly right. Where's the evidence? Let's have a trial. Let's test the evidence. Let's try the case to a jury. But, the system wasn't designed for that. The system was rigged against that, we can talk all day about the all the unnecessary actions that we took in the aftermath of September 11th. The torture report just came out.
Sure.
You can spend all day talking about that. This is another one of those. It was completely unnecessary to scoop up all these men and ship them to Guantanamo. In 1991, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, pursuant to the Geneva Convention, we had Article 5 tribunals. That's a military commission tribunal where a combatant is brought in front of a military judge, if you will, and that judge makes a determination as to whether or not they are a combatant and should be held, or whether they are civilian and should be let go. They had approximately 1,200 of those tribunals in the first Gulf War. They let 70% of the people go. Do you know how many of those they had in Afghanistan after September 11th?
No, I don't.
Zero. Zero. So, the problem with this is that it takes 1 second to call my client a terrorist. It takes me 15, 20 minutes to try and explain why that is not true.
We're talking with Michael Moen from Boston, who is representing Ali Hussein Shaban, who's been in Guantanamo since he was 19 years old. Is he 32 now? How old is
he now? He's 32, yes.
32. So we've read a lot of horrible things about Guantanamo, that the hunger strikes, the forced feedings and so forth, and separation from families. Give us a little sense of what his life has been like for these years in Guantanamo. I assume he's been separated entirely from his family.
Sure. He separated from – he's from a big family in Syria, went for years without speaking to them, until the Red Cross started setting up phone calls and Skype phone calls to his family. He was living in, Camp 5. He was in Camp 6. He was in Camp 4. He was not a committed hunger striker. He did not join the hunger strike that got so much press last year in 2013. I asked him about that. He said, I went on a hunger strike back in 2007 and nothing happened and we didn't get anything. So I felt it wasn't worth it. So, he's a very smart guy. His English is excellent. And I know he's going to learn Spanish, and it's not going to be easy here. After 12 years, 12 and a half years in Guantanamo, that takes its toll. It takes its toll on anyone. But he's got a tremendous opportunity here, and I hope he does well.
I think I read somewhere, Michael, where you sent some pages from your kid's Spanish book to help him get started learning his Spanish. Was he mistreated? Obviously he was held without charges and against him, and as you said, the charges dwindled. But was he mistreated? We've read a lot and talked a lot about this week about torture. How was his treatment in Guantanamo?
You know, in Guantanamo, I would characterize treatment as institutionalized cruelty. You know, he wasn't on the frequent flyer program, which maybe you've heard of, where, you know, they're putting somebody on sleep deprivation, loud music and all that. You know, he definitely had some mistreatment at the hands of some of the interrogators, female interrogators who, you know, did some disgusting things to him that I'm not going to talk about on the radio. Certainly when he was in Kandahar for 5 months before he came to Guantanamo, he was mistreated, beaten, et cetera. You know, but, you know, he didn't go through a thorough torture program. He didn't, you know, fortunately, he wasn't waterboarded or anything like that. And the reason is because he had no information on anything. He's a nobody. He was never involved in fighting. He wasn't captured on the battlefield. He had no information to give him.
Did he ever think he was going to get out, Michael? Was his belief that he could spend the rest of his life there?
Yeah, that's the one thing that really eats away at the men in there. It's the uncertainty, and the uncertainty really takes a toll. It's not like you're doing a 15 to 20 at Cedar Junction for armed robbery, and you know with good time maybe you get out in 11 or 12 years, and you're sitting there crossing days off the calendar. It's not like that, It's not like that. It's been very difficult.
We're talking to Michael Amon from Montevideo, where he greeted his client just released with five others to Uruguay from Guantanamo. Why do you do this, Michael? This is, for those who don't know, you do this pro bono, which means in Latin, which I don't speak, on the house. You don't charge for this. Why do you spend so much of your life, and he isn't your first such client, why do you do this?
That's a good question. I'm not going to stand here and tell you that when the first plane arrived in Guantanamo that I got out there and started shouting from the rooftops, this is a grave injustice. But, over the next couple of years, seeing that we were going to try and hold all these men down there in a legal black hole, that didn't sit with me. That didn't sit right with me. And then the whole run-up to the Iraq War, I never bought any of that nonsense that there was some kind of connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, or that he had, weapons of mass destruction. And, it was just a cumulative effect of that. And I just felt like I couldn't sit on the sidelines anymore. I had to raise my voice, even if it, no one ever heard it. I had to speak out. I couldn't just sit on the sidelines anymore. And so this was as good a way to do it as any. And, that's basically why, and honestly, the first two clients I had in 2005, I didn't have to do anything, really. They got out so quickly. I filed a habeas petition for one, and another guy, they both got released before I could really do much.
I don't think your clients would agree with the assessment of your own work, Michael. But
Michael, that's what I'm really curious about, because you are representing a man who's been held unjustly since he was 19, is now 32, by the United States of America. You are, of course, an American, so you helped him get out. I wonder how he feels about the United States of America at this stage of the game.
I think that he has no animosity towards American people. He used to, love America, loved Americans, heard about America, thought it was a great country. And he has no animosity towards the American people. Obviously he's not too pleased with the U.S. government.
Yep.
It's incongruous, isn't it, for them? And it must be hard to get their heads around that on the one hand, America grabs you, picks you up, throws you in on an island prison, holds you there for 12 years. Yet at the same time, they're going to allow an American lawyer to come down and fight like heck to try and get you out. But isn't that who we are? That's who we are, and we have to get back to that.
Well, speaking of contradictions, we have a president who ran on a platform that six years ago that included shutting down Guantanamo, and obviously there's very small progress in that direction. And at the same time that he says that continues to be his goal, he signs defense authorizations that undercut his own plans to close it down. He fires the guy, the ambassador, what was his name, Freed, who was the guy who was trying to make this happen. So what is your assessment of what Obama really wants here and why this has been such an unsuccessful effort on his part?
Jim, don't get me started. You know, he had an opportunity. You know, he had an opportunity in 2009 when Greg Craig and, you know, some of the other folks in his administration had put together a plan to relocate two of the Uyghurs who had been unjustly detained at Guantanamo for years. And they were going to bring them to, you know, the Washington, D.C. area, Northern Virginia. And they had lined up church groups who were going to take care of them and look after them. And there's a large Uyghur community, you know, but word leaked of that. And, you know, the local Republican congressman started to raise holy hell. And then obviously Fox News got it. There was a moment there in that speech he was about to give in May of 2009 at the National Archives. And he could have got up there and given a full-throated defense of his policy and his decision to shut down Guantanamo. And he could have said that, you know, we've made a mistake and we've sent hundreds of men down there who are, you know, have no connection to terrorism, who are largely innocent, most of them, and we need to face facts and shut this place down and do the right thing by those guys. He could have done it, but he didn't. And that's laid out in books. Dan Clayman, I think, wrote a great book on killer capture where he describes that whole process. And he basically, you know, chose politics over principle. And, you know, Guantanamo became the, you know, sort of ugly redheaded stepchild. And you know, he chose to fight and not to fight on that issue because he thought it was going to undermine his you know, his drive to try and pass healthcare reform. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, and then he just kept getting rolled and rolled again and again. Look at the decision to try Eric Holder, you know, his decision that they're going to put Khalid Sheikh Mohammed on trial in federal justice court in New York, you know, and eventually, you know, they fell back when the protests and hue and cry became too much. They wouldn't stand for principles, you know.
And the issue there, for those who don't know, the issue there, the whole protest was we shouldn't be trying him in a civilian court when, in fact, the record of convictions is quite high in these courts, despite what the critics have said.
It's staggeringly high compared to 8 convictions in the military commission tribunals. It's not even comparable.
Michael, we have about a minute and a half left. Ali is now in a foreign country, Spanish-speaking, only 300 Muslims. He's a Muslim himself, far away from his family. What does the future look like for him?
Well, you know, it's not going to be without its challenges, certainly. He needs to learn a language. That is a tremendous hurdle that must be breached and must be cleared if you're going to have a successful integration. You know, he needs to, he would like to go back to school. You know, he wants to study and find work, and it's going to be a challenge. It's a challenge for all the men. It's a challenge for anyone who, you know, walks out of U.S. prison. But, you know, the one thing he has, I will say this, the one thing that these men, that Ali has and that these other men have, that other detainees have not had, is they have the total unreserved commitment of the president of the country that they've been released into. Mm-hmm. President Mujica, he did 14 years in a jail as a political prisoner. So, and the gentlemen who are working with their integration, you know, he did time as a political prisoner. They get it. And they, you know, President Mujica was quoted the other day. He doesn't consider them released prisoners. He considers them victims of a kidnapping. So the one thing they have going for them is they have the complete and utter support of the president in this country. And while it's a small country, 3 million people, they're not the wealthiest nation in the world, but you know, they've got the best intentions, and, you know, I think there'll be a lot of challenges, and the men have to be patient. Ali has to be patient about how things progress, but ultimately they have a really, really good chance of rebuilding their lives here.
We hope
so. And as Mujica once said, putting down roots here and starting a family and building their lives here.
Michael, thanks so much for your time.
Congratulations for this great day for you and for Ali. Thank you very much for being with us, Michael. Michael practices civil litigation at Easdale Barrett Jacobs and Moen Law Firm in Boston. He also represents Guantanamo detainees on a pro bono basis. Up next, we're going to be joined by Rich Davey, the former CEO and Secretary of Transportation. We're going to talk to him about the bridges in Massachusetts. Are they falling down or not? We're going to talk to him about the Olympics as well. What he thinks about having them to help those roads and bridges. All that up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is the man formerly known as the CEO and Secretary of Transportation, Rich Davey. In November, he resigned from that high-profile post, so now he goes by a streamlined title, Rich. Rich Davey, welcome back to Boston Public Radio.
You know, exactly. The formerly known as Prince. Yeah.
By the way, Marjorie says to Rich when he walks in the studio, "So what are you doing?" And he says, absolutely nothing.
That's right. Well, he stepped down.
I jealously told you I had my Christmas shopping done.
Yeah,
it's,
I know.
It's good to be
I
me.
Know. You're playing with the cast and having a very relaxing time. So you left in November as CEO of Secretary of Transportation. Let's just look a little bit backwards, Rich. I mean, it's been called a thankless job, what you were doing there. So what worked out that you could be a little thankful for, and what was just a big crisis? Start with what was the good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think getting revenue for the first time in a generation to invest back in the system. I'd like to think, and I think people have told this to me, that we instilled some more faith back into transportation. We're not talking about the big dig as the very first byline, but it's, you know, we have a lot of successes to talk about. The tunnel that we did, you know, the Fast 14. So I hope that we've left a legacy of excellence and not depression, that we can actually get stuff done in this state. And move forward. And I think, you know, Charlie and his team have a real opportunity, and I think they'll do a good job in that regard.
Why do you think Duvall fired you? Oh, he didn't fire. I'm sorry. Okay. So what are the biggest frustrations and disappointments? I mean, you've been a lot of – well, you tell us, and then I'll tell you what I think your greatest frustrations were. Go ahead, Rich.
So, boy, biggest frustrations. You know, I think trying to move some political leadership. I think everyone acknowledges that infrastructure needs to be invested in. You hear that all the time, and not just in Massachusetts, but across the United States. And our Congress still can't figure out a way to do it. You know, I often quoted Tip O'Neill, who said, there's no such thing as a Democratic or Republican pothole. They got to be filled. But you would think that apparently there are such things as Democratic and Republican potholes. That's what frustrates me the most.
Well, but in all fairness, in this state, they're not Republican potholes because there aren't any Republicans except for Charlie Baker and Karen Pulido.
Right.
And so there are two campaigns you were involved in, which, along with your boss, the governor, one was to get $1 billion for infrastructure, transportation stuff. You got about half that, give or take a few bucks. You also were hopeful that the public would not vote as they did, 52 or 53%, to repeal the inflation adjustment on the gas tax. That all came against a backdrop of what Marjorie and I saw. You may, but you know it anyway. This 60 Minutes thing talking about how bridges are literally ready to fall down around this country. The image that will stay with me, and I know Marjorie too, is they have a diaper bridge. I think is it Pittsburgh it is? They've created essentially a cement diaper under a bridge there to protect motorists from concrete falling from the real bridge.
Or the diaper's there for other reasons.
Well, we should give the number that one out of every nine bridges in the United States of America is now considered to be structurally deficient, according to the 60 Minutes piece.
You know, it seems to me that if you had administered sodium pentothal to every member of every legislator, I'm serious, they'd all say, we know this is really bad.
Sure.
But as I've said to your former boss, I think they all make a calculation. I'm going to get out of here. I'm not going to be in office anymore when that bridge falls down, literally or figuratively. It is almost impossible to sell investment in the future, isn't it?
It is, and it's sad because I think, you know, one thing I loved working for the governor is because he talked about that generational responsibility, and more people in elected office need to think about the next, you know, 25 years, not the next 25 seconds. And legislators will remain nameless, but a couple who I spoke to, when I was making the push for revenue, said, you know, I'm with you, but I'm going to wait till the phone rings until and I'll be told how to vote. People got to vote their conscience, and they have to vote the way of thinking about the long term and not about the short term. And so, you know, again, my hope is that we got some progress made, and there are some legislators up there who made a big push and who are still in office, and I hope they will continue to make that push.
Well, you know, we talked a lot about here on the radio, Rich, about lack of trust in government, mm-hmm. and I think that was all about why the gas tax, the refusal to index the gas tax to inflation, why it didn't succeed, because I don't think it was about people not realizing that the potholes need to be fixed and the bridges are falling down. I think it was about saying, you want to raise that money, we're going to make you vote for it.
Yeah.
To me, that was what it was all about. And
I don't know how
you get beyond that with this terrible distrust here and across the country government.
So it's all about then just going back and working hard and showing people you can get stuff done. Frankly, I was surprised at how well the ballot question did. I thought we would get killed. I mean, putting taxes on a ballot is never a popular thing. There was very little, a bunch of a campaign. You know, Charlie was in favor of the ballot question. He talked about it. So
in favor of repeal.
Repeal. Yes. So, you know, we were up against it, and we only lost by, 53-47. So I think what that says is, you know, we're not quite there yet on that public trust, but I totally agree with you. It's all about public confidence. And I think, at least in transportation today, we're in a better place than we were a few years ago. People have more confidence, but we still need to build it with better projects, quick, you know, getting stuff done and just – you know, showing our competence.
I want to stay on this just for a couple of seconds. You know, you said a minute ago, I think somewhat rhetorically, I don't mean that critically, you know, you just have to be willing to invest in the future, think not mm-hmm. just about today. How do you make that case to someone? If you confront an honest member of Congress or an honest member of a candid member of the legislature, mm-hmm. and they say, well, I have two choices, Rich. I can invest $1 million, let's say, in ensuring that the bridge in my community mm-hmm. Doesn't deteriorate. And you just told me, Rich, it's probably going to have 10 more years before it's mm-hmm. a real problem. Or I can invest even half that much money in a new ice skating rink
right.
in my community. Everyone's going to get to see the results of the latter. It's concrete. I can cut the ribbon.
Right.
I can't cut the ribbon on the maintenance of the bridge so that it's safe in 10 right. years. So you tell me why I should do the right thing, as you described.
Well, we certainly had ribbon cuttings for really weird stuff. There's no doubt about that at the request of folks. No, I mean, it is. It's very hard. People like the shiny new toy, the shiny new object, a new station, not the signal system on the Green Line.
So what do you say to that legislator? What do you
say to that, you know, the Green Line will shut down. It's going to – or it's having issues today. And you can see a slow degradation of whether it's bridges, which we closed. I think there are still 50 bridges that are closed in Massachusetts.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. And we fixed a lot, but there are still 50 that are shut, closed, just period. And there are others that are weighted, which, you know, heavy trucks can't go over. So,
you know what I wonder, and I hope you know the answer to this because I certainly don't. When something like the Long Island Bridge gets shut down, and people probably know this is the bridge that was
leading. By the way, we've known that for 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
That was, I mean, this is the, as did the city, and so not a surprise to a lot of folks who know about transportation.
Did the public know?
Hold on. We should tell people what it is, in case they don't know that the Long Island Bridge was the bridge out to where there was a lot of there were shelters out there, and there were treatment facilities for people with alcohol problems and drug problems, and now all these people have been displaced and they're sort of bunking up and they're very upset about the whole thing. What I wondered about so you said it was 7 or 8 years people knew that bridge was in trouble, but how did it happen that it was like an emergency that day? I mean, does it just start to? Is it some point you figure out, and how do you figure out that if a truck goes over here, it's going to go right into the drink?
So, you know, all bridges have a regular inspection. I think that one had an even more regular inspection because it was not in good shape. The city did their regular inspection as they do. I don't know how often it was going on. And the engineers that day decided it was in such bad shape. They asked for a second opinion. I think they asked for our opinion. We said we agreed. And the city decided to close it.
But is it because because the concrete starts to fall down, or because they determine that it can't take the weight? I mean, what
it's
makes
the weight?
It...
It's the weight question.
Okay.
And I also think, given where it is, which is for folks who are listening, you know, it's a bridge that literally goes through Boston Harbor.
Right.
So if you know you had even a moderate storm that had waves, you know, coming up, it would have significantly deteriorated such that it could have collapsed. So it wasn't in imminent danger of collapse. But as I understand it, if there was even a moderate storm, it could have wiped the bridge out or certainly made it such that you couldn't have a heavy vehicle going over it. And to your point, significant vulnerable populations are out there. There's a homeless shelter. The T runs a bus out there to make sure the citizens who live in the shelter are out there. There's a detox facility, and obviously there's a summer camp for kids. So, I mean, you know, these are not the type of people you're going to be putting in.
Is Camp Harborview on? Mm-hmm. That's where it is. We've talked about Camp Harborview a lot. Yeah.
They're going to have to go on a ferry or something.
Let's use this as a case study for a couple of seconds.
Sure.
Who knew 7 years ago? Tom Menino knew 7 years ago.
I mean, I can't speak to specifically, but I'm sure that the city knew. Look, the city.
The governor knew. You knew. Transportation leaders in the House knew. So why didn't anything get done?
Money. Or priority.
And there's so many bridges. You just said the 50 are closed. Yeah. So this was the 51st or whatever.
Sure. I mean, it's all about the priority question.
So what are the things you're most – when you were Secretary of Transportation, what were the things you went to bed most nervous about saying – I mean, one of the things, reasons we admire you, we can say it now that you're gone, is you were really a pretty straight shooter, I should say, which I think people admired even if they didn't like the message all the time. The messenger, they knew it was
a
straight
arrow.
No, most
of the time they didn't like my message.
Well, I know, including us, by the way. Almost all the time we didn't like it. But what is the thing you said, you know, this has got to be dealt with? I don't mean a new project. You know, Southwest Rail, it's great. Yeah. It'll be good for the economy. What's the thing that was sitting out there that you said, this is going to be a real problem if people don't grow up and deal with it?
Yeah, nothing safe. I mean, unsafe. I mean, it wasn't like we were hiding stuff that was unsafe. I mean, anytime, particularly in the last 4.5 years, if there was a safety issue, we were on it and then came out publicly and talked about it. But I think it's that what you said earlier, which is how to explain to the public the slow degradation of a bridge. Like the Long Island Bridge, you know, I didn't know that it had to be closed. But you could see over time, whether it was 8 years or 10 years or 12 years, that bridge, if not fixed, was going to have to be closed. There are other bridges like that in the state that if they are not fixed, at some point they'll be weighted, which means heavy trucks can't go over them, and at some point they'll be closed. And it's hard to get people galvanized unless you have a crisis or a significant opportunity. You know, we got the gas tax passed, I think, in part because we cut the heck out of T service and we raised fares by 25%. 6,000 people came out to public hearings and 6,000 people showed up at the State House.
And you went to a lot of those hearings, which is the ultimate act of masochism, I should say. But go ahead.
Indeed. And so that crisis galvanized that moment. What I worry about now is, you know, the system is in decent shape. It's probably not in crisis mode. And so it's going to be hard, it seems to me, unless there's some real leadership to make a statement that, you know, we need to do more. So I think that's what keeps me up at night is only – I mean, look, the I-35 bridge in Minnesota collapsed 7 years ago.
Yes.
It killed people. Mm. People died. The federal government did what? Nothing. Nothing. States stepped up. Minnesota did. Massachusetts did, and others did. So I think that's what worries me too is if you get to that point where you're seeing, you know, something like that happen – and there's still not a response. I mean, what is going to generate a response? I don't know. That's what frightens me.
You know what I often wonder, too, and I'm not a world traveler like Jim, who's always jetting off somewhere here and there. But when I do jet off somewhere, Charlestown doesn't count. I'm always stunned how here we are, the United States of America, the richest country on earth, mm-hmm. and you go to other countries.
Here she goes. You're so right.
That are democracies or social mm-hmm. democracies, or they're not like totalitarian. I've never been to one.
They're also much older than the United States.
Yes, and you get there, and the airport is gorgeous. The taxis that take you from the airport into the hotel are gorgeous. The subway system is gorgeous, and I wonder how do they do it. How do they do it, Rich?
So it depends on – so, for example, I had a chance to be in Paris a couple months ago.
Gorgeous.
Did we pay for that or not?
Yes, except that it's not accessible at all. I had to help a woman with her baby carriage up the stairs because there isn't an escalator or an elevator to be found in the entire metro system.
I did not know
for the most part in Paris. So it is a well-run system, but if you don't walk, you can't use it. So not helpful. With that said – look, there are a few things. One is, depending on the society, you know, taxes are higher for transportation. There's a greater push for public transit as opposed to the car. You know, we invested in the 1950s in the interstate highway system, not in transit necessarily. That's been a change for sure. And I think the other thing on political leadership that I've seen is those who tell you can have it all and you don't have to pay for it, be very skeptical, folks. It's one or the other. You either have to pay for it and we'll have a world-class system, or we won't, and we won't. And that's the choice. But when people say you can have it all and you have to pay for it, that is not a choice.
Do you have a formal position on the Olympics coming in Boston in 2024?
I do. I think it's a good idea, actually.
And do you think the first person that spoke to us about John Fish was here a few months ago, from Suffolk Construction, the leader of the effort, Marty Walsh, here every month, mayor. Both of them have said similar sorts of things, is that this is a perfect opportunity to look to where we want Massachusetts, Boston, Greater Boston to be, the 2020s, the 2030s. And they also contend, so it's a two-part question, they also contend that every single nickel in transportation work that would need to be done for Olympics is already in the pipeline. Start with that. Is that true?
So, you know, I haven't seen the bid.
No one has seen the bid.
Right. So I assume in good faith that what's in the bid is asked for, like the Green Line extension, for example. As I understand it, that would be important to Somerville. That's happening for sure. The federal government just announced $1 billion just a couple weeks ago. That's good news. Look, you know, the transportation plan that we put out 2 years ago wasn't entirely funded, and then the gas tax question passed. So that means further cuts are going to have to happen. So there are going to have to be some choices that Governor Baker will need to make. But I think it's doable. I certainly think it's doable.
Meaning some things that may have had higher priority may get secondary priority because the originally higher priority things are not Olympic related.
Right.
So you may get pushed to the back seat so that the Olympics related things can be moved into the front seat. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. But I think what's fairer is that a lot of the improvements that were going to happen in the metropolitan Boston area, new red and orange line cars, for example, expanding South Station, the Green Line extension, which I'm going to assume are part of the argument that the Olympics can happen in Boston in 10 years, should happen anyways. There may be some other projects that get cut, again, that Governor Baker's team is going to have to think about. Or in the meantime, you know, finding new ways of revenue. Some have talked about an internet sales tax and other ways to fund things like transportation in the future. So I think you're right to ask, you know, there are more questions, but this goes back to my crisis opportunity. Selfishly, I think the Olympics can be the opportunity that actually gets people focused again on transportation. I don't see the crisis coming soon, unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, but that could be the opportunity where people say, you know what, we want South Station expansion, we want new red line cars, et cetera, et cetera.
We're talking with Rich Davey, who stepped down as Secretary of Transportation in November. But you have indicated, Rich, that even though you're going into the private sector for a while, you might come into politics later on. So do you know what you're doing? I mean, you said you were playing with your cats and your home having bought all your Christmas presents already.
But I mean,
do you know what you want to do? What you'd like to do next?
I don't. I'm casting my net wide, talking to folks. You know, it's really hard to look for a job when you have that secretary job. So I was really careful to say, you know what, I'm going to leave and then start to have conversations after. But I don't. I'm blessed to have a patient spouse. So my wife is giving me some time to, you know, think about what's next.
That's great.
And, you know, as it snows out here today, I was happy to not be dealing with another winter and take a little time off. So hopefully after the new year, I'll be doing something.
Hey, don't go away for a minute. Your former boss also has weighed in on the Uber versus taxi cab conundrum, saying there should be some regulations, essentially a level playing field, kind of not being anti-Uber. I didn't realize. You know who's behind the whole Uber thing? Or one of the lead people? David Plouffe. Mr. Barack Obama, Mr. Deval Patrick. Yeah. So where are you on this thing? You're a modern kind of guy.
I'm a modern.
You're a pro.
I mean, use Uber.
What?
I mean, I personally use Uber. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
Should it be regulated?
It should be lightly regulated. Mm-hmm. And I think the taxi industry should be less regulated, to be frank.
How so? What would you pull back?
Well, for one, you know, the idea that these licenses that the city gives to taxi cab drivers or frankly, taxi companies that—
The medallions, you mean?
Medallions, yeah. But they're really licenses.
Right.
Right? They're owned by the city, not by the person. But they accumulate the wealth and the transfer goes to the owner, not to the city. I mean, I don't understand that as a citizen. I just don't understand that.
Because they're worth hundreds—
They're worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that's my point. They're government licenses issued by the city. So— I don't know how that works. In any event.
That's a great point, actually.
So,
you know, if you go down and get a marriage license, it's not worth anything. You go down and get a license to operate a small business, it's not
worth. Don't take this lightly, honey. But so if I go get another wife, I can't take the license with me. I get another one, right?
No, and she it's not won't mine. Take that lightly. That's not an issue at all. Honey, as we call you, yes.
Yeah, no, I'm in trouble now. But no, but I'm a big fan of it. I think what Uber has done is actually, it should be lightly regulated for sure. And it's pushed the envelope to have a conversation about the taxi cab industry, which, you know, has been widely written, itself has significant challenges. And at the end of the day, I think it's the individual driver that is, you know, working hard and kind of getting hosed, certainly by some of the taxi companies. You know, they're not making a lot of money. They have to rent the car. They have to rent the medallion. I think it's great technology, and it's also giving us – I mean, look, it's giving us – I mean, have you ever had a bad cab experience?
Many bad cab experiences.
When was the last time you called the Hackney hotline in New York or Boston to complain?
I haven't. I should have.
Exactly.
Yeah, I haven't.
But Uber, you can, at the end of the ride, rate the person 1 through 5.
Yep.
There is significant and immediate
accountability. So it's like ongoing regulation, you're saying.
Yeah. And by the way, if they're not a good driver, Uber gets rid of them, as I understand it. So I've had tough cab drivers too. I've never called. There's no accountability in that system. The technology gives the consumer accountability. That's what I like about it.
You know what it sounds like to me, reading between the lines, Marjorie? I don't want to confront Rich Davey. It sounds like he's going to be an Uber driver. Practically.
Maybe. I got to buy a car first.
Can I call you directly or should I just go through the app?
How'd you get here today? How'd you get here?
Well, the T.
The T. You got here on the T.
You are unbelievable.
And a
you
bus.
You really are a true believer. This is the same guy jumped over Turnstile to apprehend a toll violator not too many years ago. Rich, now that you're going, we can say you did terrific work. And
I appreciate
so much.
I think he's going to be back in the public sector soon. I see that
he
coming.
He may be.
Okay,
Rich Davey, great to see you.
But right now, he is the former CEO and Secretary of Transportation doing his Christmas shopping and playing with his cats. His name is Rich Davey. Thank you so much for being here.
I can do your Christmas shopping, too, as I offer to the both of you.
Personal shopper, Rich Davey. Exactly.
Coming up, the great singer-songwriter Tom Rush joins us. He's going to preview his upcoming performance at Symphony Hall later this month. And he's also going to play us a couple of songs. I'm so excited. Cool. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 is the legendary folk singer-songwriter Tom Rush. He's returning to Symphony Hall on December 28th. I will be there to continue his series of Club 47 concerts. He'll also be celebrating the official release of the documentary of his life called Tom Rush, No Regrets.
In my putting my own act together and presenting myself, Tom is definitely the model for it. Without any question more than anyone else.
He nailed the singer-songwriter thing by including Jackson Browne, Joni Mitchell, and a song by James Taylor before anybody had heard of these people. Tom was best of class and would lead and inspire ultimately many other artists on the label.
Those are the voices, obviously, of James Taylor, local kid, and the second voice is that of Elektra Records founder Tom Holtzman. Speaking about local kids, in studio with us is Tom Rush. Tom, so good to meet you.
It's so good to be here.
So you're going to be at Symphony Hall on the 28th again. How many times have you done this?
Well, depends on how you count it. I did a string of them. I played Symphony Hall way, way back before you were born.
Oh, right. Yeah. Thank you.
But I did a string of what I call Club 47 shows with a bunch of different artists starting in 1981 up through 85 or 86, I think. And then the Boston Pops decided they wanted that time slot for themselves, so I couldn't get the hall back. Then 2 years ago, I was celebrating 50 years on stage and discovered the hall was, in fact, available on the 28th. So I did a show. Then we did it again last year, and so this will be the third in a row of this particular run.
And is Club 47 Club Passim now? Is that where?
Well, no.
No?
Yes,
okay.
Yes and no. It's the same location. Uh-huh. It's the same music, same mission statement, but it's basically not genetically related.
You know, Tom, I have to say, in the spirit of full disclosure, I always say this when I have a moment, which is a spirit I embrace as infrequently as possible. When I was young, I wanted to be you. I wanted to sing like you. I wanted to play like you. When you grew a mustache, I wanted that. I couldn't grow a mustache, but I couldn't, and I couldn't play and sing either. And you were a really sexy guy.
Oh,
you were
on.
One of the cutest men.
You may have wanted
who has
to
ever
be
walked.
Him. I thought, you know, maybe this would be my fantasy date. You know, especially the album with your whole face on it. You know, that big face on it.
I am serious. I mean,
this is actually a paste-on mustache. I'll lend it to you.
Okay, so I've gotten that out of my system. You were a Harvard kid, and when Marjorie and I were talking about this before, was that an inhibitor or innate? I was trying to think. Who is another Harvard grad who has gone on to the level of musical success and acclaim that you did? Is there somebody?
Pete Seeger didn't graduate.
Right, right, right.
I don't know anybody else in my end of the music business. I'm sure there's some classical.
But it was an
players.
Asset to you, right? Being in Cambridge
certainly
at that time.
Being in Cambridge was an absolutely essential piece of the puzzle because there was so much music going on, and I just got sucked into it. And
one of the great things I was reading the material this morning in anticipation of you being here was the hootenannies. You talk about hootenannies. I thought, wow, that's a word I haven't heard for a long time. Tell people who may not remember, what was a hootenanny, please?
Well, nowadays they're open mics.
Yeah.
But basically, it's, you know, a whole bunch of people show up and do a couple of songs apiece. And back then, there was no real juries or anything. You didn't have to pass a test to get on stage if you were brave enough to do it. Up you went. And so I don't actually remember playing hootenannies, but they were very popular. People,
yeah, huge.
A lot of people would come just to see what was going on.
Yeah, we just heard what James Taylor talk about, what an inspiration you were in his career in so many ways. You knew the woman I consider to be the greatest songwriter of the last half century before anybody knew Joni Mitchell. How'd you meet Joni Mitchell? Where'd you hear her for the first time?
I was playing a club in Detroit, Michigan. A place called The Chessmate, and I had a 2-week gig there, and Joni came in one night. She was just down from Toronto, just getting her bearings, had just started writing songs, and she came in and asked the owner if she could do a guest set so I could hear some of her stuff, and just bowled me over. And I asked her then, I was way over deadline for delivering an album to Elektra, 2 years over deadline, which back then seemed like a long time. But I asked her if she had any more songs, and she basically said no, but give me a minute. And went home, and a couple of weeks later sent me a tape with 6 songs on it.
Wow.
And then she actually apologized for the last song on the tape. She said, I just finished writing this. It's not for you. It's terrible. I'm so embarrassed. Here it is.
Don't tell me it's Urge for Going.
Circle Game.
Oh, so
she thought that was terrible?
She wasn't happy with it.
Did she say why? What was wrong with it?
Well, I think it was just brand new, and maybe she felt it wasn't quite done yet.
Yeah.
Sounded pretty darn good to me.
How good? Did you know the first time you heard her sing how good she was?
I knew that she was that the first time I heard her sing, she did Urge for Going. And I just loved that song. I knew I had to do that song as quickly as possible.
We're talking to Tom Rush. Tom is going to be, his Club 47 holiday tradition continues, as it says, Boston Symphony Hall, Sunday, December 28th. We obviously have a lot to talk to you about, but you're going to play for us, too.
I am.
You want to play something now?
Sure.
What would that be?
What would you like? I've got a couple of new songs.
Well, can we cut a deal right here?
Sure.
You start with a new song. As long, Marjorie and I are fighting over what we really want you to play. So you play something new, and then after we've talked a little more, you can settle a dispute between us and play one of your older classics. Is that a deal?
Sounds good.
Fine. And you're a Portsmouth kid, right?
Born in Portsmouth. I didn't actually ever live there.
Oh, you didn't? No, I didn't know that.
I left at about 2 days of age.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Concord, New Hampshire. My daddy taught at St. Paul's School, so I was a faculty brat.
Mm-hmm.
And you were adopted, too, which I did not know.
Yeah, I'm an adopted kid.
So the musical genes it came from someplace else, not from the mom and dad that brought you up.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Did you ever find it? You ever wanted to go find bio mom and dad?
I did, in fact. excuse me. My mom had died. I did connect with my father. It's in the documentary. What's not in the documentary is that my mom went on to have three other boys, two of whom one had died, one had disappeared. But the last of them was a guy named Jeff Cotton, who was a composer.
Mm. Really?
And, yeah.
So was it mom or dad that had the music thing going on?
I don't know. I met my dad. He didn't play instruments or anything.
Do you know if mom did?
Her dad did.
Huh.
So I guess my genetic grandfather.
And what about the brother? Have you maintained a relationship?
What is this, ancestry.com? Well, I want to hear this guy play.
Yeah, I just think it's a fascinating thing. Just that one last thing.
Okay, go ahead.
He died actually a couple of years ago, very abruptly. But he was a well-known, established composer. His works were being performed by symphonies and stuff like that.
Oh my goodness!
Like
so he was writing classical music.
He was writing, classical kind of stuff, and I called him up. I met my aunt, my genetic aunt. She said, well, Jeff, here's his number, but give me a couple of days to contact him so you don't knock him over because he knows nothing about you. And I waited a couple of days, and I called him, but his aunt had not contacted him. So it was a bit of a strange conversation.
Did he know who you were?
He knew my name, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, wow. So what are you playing for us, Tom Rush?
I'm going to do you a new song this is a melody that kind of woke me up out of a deep sleep, and I really didn't want to get up to do it. I asked the muse if she'd come back in the morning, and she said no, but if you don't want it, I'll go give it to Arlo. So this is what woke me up. Hanging there on the vine, moon is hanging up in the sky. My baby loves me. Oh, life is fine. Hound dog lying here at my feet. Little one is sound asleep. My baby loves me. Oh, life is sweet. Sun don't shine. She says that doesn't matter. It's a new song. She says she'll love me when I'm old and fat and getting fatter. Appreciating how the moon does shine. Sitting and listening to some old John Prine. My baby loves me. Oh, life is fine. Fish are biting and the beer is cold. The night is young and the bourbon's old. My baby loves me. Oh, life is gold. We don't care when the cold wind blows. We just snuggle closer. And when I say I love you most, she says, I love you moster. dusting off in the pines. Church bell says it's 9:30. My baby loves me. Oh, life is fine. Come on, woman, won't you dance with me? You bring the baby and we'll make three. And if you love me, oh, life's a dream. So life is love, and love is life, and so the world goes round. Be happy just as long as that woman lets me hang around. Tomatoes hanging there on the vine, moon is hanging up in the sky. Baby loves me. Oh, life is fine. My baby loves me. Oh, life is fine.
Oh, yes, the great Tom Rush.
That was a terrific great love song. You got a lucky wife. That's a lovely love song. That's a lovely, lovely love song. And you know something else? You mustn't have smoked because your voice has not changed.
Well, I used to smoke a lot.
Did you? And when did you quit?
And I quit on my 30th birthday. Okay. And I was very worried it would wreck my voice.
Quitting?
Quitting.
Oh, yeah, my goodness.
Because I had this, you know, kind of husky thing going on, and it actually didn't seem to help or hurt.
Do you want to ask him about his aunt on his mother's side?
No,
or do you want to be done with that?
No, but I remember.
Oh, that's an interesting story.
But, you know, Joni Mitchell, who's a smoker, it has really affected her voice because it's gone lower and lower and lower. And so, obviously, good thing you quit when you were 30 because your voice sounds the same.
So, Tom Rush, what's with the documentary? We saw the trailer this morning. And the trailer's great, by the way. It's Tom Rush, No Regrets, after one of the great songs of our time. What's the deal with this? What is it?
Some guys, a couple of movie makers, Todd Quate and Rob Stegman, allowed me to be part of a documentary about the Club 47 called For the Love of the Music, and that's where we met. And then I got them to do a quick song video on my one and only children's song called the Fish Story Song. And they decided they wanted to do a documentary on me for reasons I still don't quite grasp.
So for those of us who are students of Tom Rush, what are we going to learn about you that we didn't know before?
Well, you got to get the documentary.
That means he doesn't remember.
He's a good advertiser.
I know there were some showings. It's not formally out yet, is it, or is it?
Well, it's not out, but it is available at TomRush.com.
Oh, it is.
And also the box office Symphony Hall will sell you a copy.
So tell people, I mean, we are in Boston, only a couple of miles away from Cambridge. Tell people about them. I mean, you've got great anecdotes about, you know, how you get your first album, the guy that came through the tape recorder and stuff like that. But tell people what the scene was like then, you know, when you were at Harvard and this whole folk music thing was starting.
Well, it pretty much wrecked my academic career. I almost flunked out of Harvard. I left, actually, for a year, withdrew, and then reapplied and got back in to finish up.
What year was it that you withdrew in?
In the middle of my junior year.
Okay.
It became clear that I was going to flunk out if I didn't drop out.
Because you were playing all the time.
I was playing a lot. Yeah. Hanging out at the Club 47 and some of the other places. It was a fantastic scene. The Club 47 in particular was wonderful because they made a point of going out and finding the old-timers, the legends, and bringing them in, the people whose 78s we were, you know, collecting.
Oh, gosh.
And they'd sometimes get these people out of retirement. But you could sit at the feet of the Carter family in that little 80-seat room. It was astounding. And I remember thinking, and there was so much good music going on just around town with, you know, Jeff Muldaur and Jim Queskin, and Baez had kind of fledged by that point, but
Joan Baez, she kind of what? She kind of what?
Fledged.
Oh, taken off.
She'd kind of, yeah.
Okay.
Moved on. But there's so much good music going on. And I remember thinking at the time, this really has to be extraordinary. It seems like everyday life, but this can't be everyday life. This has got to be something special. And in retrospect, it certainly was.
Didn't you do something with the Harvard radio station, too? Didn't you have a connection?
WHRB.
What'd you do there?
I had a 30-minute folk show on Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock, Balladeers, I think.
And so, do you play, or did you play the music of people you loved?
It was kind of a song swap thing. I'd play the theme, and then you know, I'd do a song or two, but my guest would do most of the most of the music. But I got to meet Pete Seeger that way. I got to, you know, Odetta came on, Jesse Lone Cat Fuller.
Wow. It's really, you know, the Pete Seeger thing. I mean, when you see in his 90s that he, a good friend of mine runs Farm Aid with Willie Nelson, and, you know, he was there, I guess, just a year ago in his 90s,
yeah,
still preaching his politics and still singing beautifully. I mean, what an inspiration this guy was to so many people, not only people who do what you do, but people who just listen.
Yeah, everybody, everybody. I mean, the fact that the man lived by his principles and...
I know. That's very unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, in this day and
age. Yeah, it's very unusual. So tell people the story about how you got your first album. What happened?
A guy named Danny Flickinger came down the stairs into the Unicorn Coffee House, which was on Boylston Street, just across from what is now the Prudential Center. And he said, "Hey, kid, you want to make a record?" And I heard this several times already, and nothing ever happened. So I said, "Sure, why not?" And to my surprise, he actually showed up with a tape recorder, this thing the size of a washing machine. He dragged, nothing was miniaturized then. He dragged this down the steps and recorded two different nights. And boom, that was my first album.
How did it do?
It, I think we, my gosh, we sold, I must have been 300 copies.
Yeah.
But, did you think
I thought
you
it was 600?
As you, I mean, this. I know it's a weird question. How good did you
think
you were?
It's a weird question, Jim.
No, but I mean, how good did you think you were? I know you love doing. I've read a lot about you. I know you love doing what you're doing. But did you think you were as good as everybody came to acknowledge?
No,
really, or are you just humble?
No. It's a reality check.
You know? So when did you know? I got it. There are people.
I'm
out
still
there
waiting for that moment.
You know,
okay,
so,
looking forward to it.
There's a great headline in the Harvard Magazine calls you the socially acceptable
bohemian. I love that line.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what is that about, please, Tom Rush?
I think a girl could feel she could bring me home to the parents and
it would be okay, even though
I was a folk singer.
Yeah. Well, there must have been a lot of women chasing you around Cambridge, I imagine, when you were...
No.
Nothing like that. Oh, okay.
So, you know, a couple of minutes ago, you said, "What do you want us to play?" Now, let me tell you what I'd like you to play. And then, Marjorie, you played something
And
new.
Then, Marjorie, can tell me what I will play.
No, I'm afraid. I have to say, and I hope the fact that it's on my iPod will count for something. Urge for Going, I think, is one of the most beautiful songs ever written. Would you agree with that, Marjorie?
It's a very nice song. Yes,
okay,
it is.
Fine. Now, Marjorie, would you agree that Making Me Happy by having Tom Rush in person play one of the most beautiful songs of all time would be a great moment for all of us?
Been talking about your arrival for like 4 days.
I may have been.
And we've heard
about
Urge for Going for 4 days. So I don't want to, you know, for the interest of our report here on air, go ahead, Jim.
You know,
you get your wish.
But before you play it, you were kind enough to say, "What do you want us to play? What do you want me to play?" Joni Mitchell, since we spoke of it, one of the lines I remember from one of her live albums, someone yells out at a concert, "Play, I don't know what it was, some one a Case of You or something like this." And she says, and I couldn't tell if she was angry or trying to be funny. She says, "You know, no one ever asked Van Gogh to paint A Starry Night Again, man." She says, do you ever get aggravated that people want to hear the classics and don't only want to hear what the new Tom Rush is all about?
In fact, I am blessed, Jim, with an audience that is actually very interested in new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fact. They like the new stuff as well as they like the old. Of course, they come to hear the old. And some of my contemporaries say, "Oh, I'm not going to do any of the old stuff. It's, you know, I just want to do that." I don't think that's fair. People come to hear a certain list of songs, and it's not fair not to do a
So
few
what you're
of
basically
them.
Saying is it's time to sing Urge for Going for you, Jim.
Hold
is
on.
That what you're
before
saying?
You,
is that where you're
before,
going with this?
Before you play Urge for Going, well, you can play Urge for Going, but
I'm like vibrating here, Marjorie. Let's get with it.
You were in some Hawaiian shirt somewhere with palm trees. I saw this thing. I don't know where you were, Florida or Hawaii or something, playing the Remember song about losing everything. And I thought that was pretty great, too. And that's a new song, I presume.
That's actually on YouTube. It's got over 6 million hits at this point.
It's a riot.
That's like a sequel to the Circle Game, isn't that the whole notion behind it? Sort of.
It's. I didn't actually write the tune, but I can't remember who did.
Is that true?
No, Stephen Walters wrote it.
Oh, you do. Okay, fine.
Stephen Walters wrote it, and it's a great song about a guy who can't remember anything.
Yeah,
it's
looking for his phone. We can
all
relate to that.
My wife does think that the 6.5 million plays on YouTube are probably just one guy. Can't remember, he's already seen it.
Okay, here's the great Tom Rush playing one of the great songs ever.
Tuning his guitar to start with.
How old is that guitar?
I think it's 1977.
Wow.
very first songs I ever heard Joni play. And I woke up today and found the frost perched on the town. It hovered in a frozen sky, gobbled summer down. When the sun turns traitor cold, and shivering trees are standing in a naked row, I get the urge for going. Seem to go, and I get the urge for going when the meadow grass is turning brown. Summertime is falling down, winter closing in. Summertime with summer colored skin, and not another man in town my darling's heart could win. When the leaves fell trembling down, and bully winds rub their faces in the snow, she got the urge for going, and I had to let her go. And she got the urge for going when the meadow grass was turning brown. Summertime was a falling. Winter closing in. Now the warriors of winter give a cold triumphant shout, and all that stays is dying. All it lives is getting out. See the geese in chevron flight, flapping and racing on before the snow. They've got the urge for going, they've got the wings to go. And they get the urge for going when the meadow grass is turning brown. Summertime is falling down, winter closing in. Apply the fire with kindling, pull the blankets to my chin, and I'll lock the vagrant winter out and bolt my wandering in. I'd like to call back summertime and have her stay just another month or so. She's got the urge for going, and I guess she'll have to go. And she gets the urge for going when the meadow. winter closing in. And I get the urge for going when the meadow grass is turning brown. Summertime is falling down.
Man, that was fabulous. Okay. Tom Rush.
Jim spooning over here. Man. He's
hey,
spooning.
Tom, I know you can go to bso.org to get tickets for your thing at Symphony Hall on the 28th. Can they do it through tomrush.com too?
There's a link at tomrush.com that'll take you to BSO and will also take you to the store where you can buy the documentary and a whole lot of other good Christmas presents.
I bet that's the case.
And tell us, I should mention
at the Symphony Hall show, my guests this year are going to be a trio of three women, fabulous singers and instrumentalists called Red Molly. A young lady named Monica Rizzio, who used to be a lead singer for Tripping Lily, and she's now formed a new band called Old Highway that she fronts. A multi-instrumentalist. I'm hoping to get her to play some fiddle with me. And a sax player, a young...
she's local, the sax player.
Brooklyn.
Grace Kelly,
Grace
right?
Kelly. Yeah. She's absolutely local.
She is unbelievable. She's great.
I've not had the pleasure of working with her before, but everybody I've met says that she's great to work with.
Yeah, she came and spoke at one of my kids' high school graduations in Brooklyn. She played the sax and she talked and she was terrific.
And I have a sax player in my band, so I'm hoping we can get some sax duets going, and, you know, it's going to be a romantic evening.
It was a romantic afternoon, let me tell you.
People come all dressed up and they come in blue jeans, but it's candlelight, you know, candlelight, and they've got the table set up
really?
On the main floor.
That's great.
Yeah, no, they set the.
Oh, so it's
main,
like the pops with the.
It's,
where you
it's
can
the
eat
pop
and
setup.
Drink. Oh,
exactly.
That's great.
So it's bso.org or tomrush.com. This is December 28th, Boston Symphony Hall. Tom, it was a pleasure to meet you. You're really generous with your time. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me on.
It was a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much. Tom Rush is a legendary folk singer, songwriter. He will return to Symphony Hall to continue his series of Club 47 concerts, as we just said, but I'll say it again. Sunday, December 28th, 7:30. He'll also be celebrating the official release of the documentary we've been talking about, Tom Rush, No Regrets, which is also a fantastic song. Thank you so much for being here. Coming up, I'm going to ask you, is it better to give than re-gift? The holidays best to worst use of recycling next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And as is our holiday tradition here with me and Marjorie, it's that time of year to talk about regifting. A recent poll says 83% say it's okay. We want to know if you're in the majority. It's 877-301-8970. Is it better to be upfront when you're doing the regift thing, or is it okay to pass it off like you actually bought it? And for those three people out there that don't know what regifting is, you get something given to you, and then you choose to give it as a gift to someone else, generally, despite the question I just asked, without letting that person know
right.
that it has been regifted. Our number is 877-301-8987. Now, we should start this off, Marjorie. Every year you tell a story that is a painful one about a gift that was given to you by your closest friend, who shall remain unnamed. What exactly
happened?
She's
heard it about half the times I've told it to. So if you're listening today, Jan, this is for you.
What happened?
Well, she's one of my dearest friends, and she came over to my house, I think on the 23rd of Christmas, mm-hmm. and gave me this beautiful, I think it was scented soaps. I think that's what
that's really nice.
I opened them up and said, oh, these are gorgeous. Wow. I really love them. And then the next day on Christmas Eve, I went over to her house.
Wait, stop for a second. So the next day, the day after she gave you these, you went to her house.
I think it was the next day.
Okay, it was 24 hours later. Go ahead.
And I hadn't got her a gift, and I saw the scented soaps under the tree. I said, these would be great. I'll wrap these up and give them to Jan. Mm-hmm. And I wrapped them up.
Gave them to her. Not realizing that she had that been the person who had given them to
you. And she was so funny. She opens it up and she said, oh, these look so familiar. And of course, I realized, oh my God, she gave them to me the night before. Luckily, she had a good sense of humor about it.
So the point is, if you're going to do regifting, you have to be careful. There's a great piece in the New York Times a couple of years ago that we were reading. Said, don't give a gift card to someone that's inscribed to someone else. Don't give away fancy food with an expiration tag from the 1990s. My favorite was, you have freshly washed pajamas. You got them. You wore them once. You didn't like them. You try to pass them off as new when you give them to somebody, Marjorie. And the problem is there is a sock and a dryer sheet inside the legs.
That's terrible.
So you have to be careful. So we want to know if you practice regifting or think it's okay. If you do, what are your sort of rules of the game? And if you're against it, and I have to say I'm not a huge advocate of it, even though I know in tough economic times it's a plus. Which side are you on? 877-301-8987. That's a frightening tale you told.
You know what people always want to regift? They want to regift bottles of liquor. And one of these stories calls champagne the new fruitcake, with people mm-hmm. passing around the champagne somebody else gave them.
Well, that's pretty safe, too, to do.
Well, not always.
Why?
Because a lot of the bottles, the gift bags for bottles, come with gift tags attached. So you have to
say your name
really
on it, yeah.
careful that you take off the gift tag, and then the person wonders, why isn't the gift tag on there? Because if you go to a liquor store or CVS or Walgreens, wherever you want to buy your gift bags, notice that most of the bottle mm-hmm. gift bags have a gift tag attached.
You know what you can do, actually? This is a very creative suggestion I've come up with through the years. You buy a new gift bag with a new tag. And you fill it out for 69 cents.
That's what you have to do. You have to buy a new gift bag. But if you're pressed for time, Jim, you try to pull it off with the old one.
Was there any part of you, it isn't like you were suffering through an economic downturn when you regifted the soaps to Jen. Did you feel, were there any pangs of guilt? I don't mean that you gave it to her because you didn't know you gave it to the person who gave it.
Well, I didn't feel
did
that bad.
Did you feel
bad.
That you were giving her something, sort of a used
no,
stuff?
I didn't feel that bad because I thought, how much time did she really think about the soaps for me? About as much time as I was thinking about the soaps for her.
Wow, that is really...
Well, when you give someone scented soaps for a present, it's okay as a housewarming gift for someone you don't know very well and stuff like that. I mean, there are some people, like my sister, who gets these unbelievable thoughtful gifts. She collects them during the year.
That's really nice.
She gets everything wrapped by October. They're, pictures of wonderful moments in your life. Certain things inscribed. I mean, very, very thoughtful gifts. And some people give scented soaps. Mm. And I, unfortunately, am too often in the latter category. And so I'm not
so it's a passive-aggressive act on your part.
No, it's a last-minute thing. I'm a big procrastinator. I'm already in a panic now. What does it say, the 11th?
And, it is.
How's your Christmas shopping going, Jim?
I'm done.
You are not.
I haven't started. Let's go to Dan in Boston. You're first on the regifting segment here on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Dan. Which side are you on?
I'm actually on Marjorie's side this time first time in a long time.
I should hope so.
I'm with you, Jim.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Dan.
I feel like you guys are calling it the wrong thing, though. It's not regifting. It's repurposing.
repurposing.
That's so clever.
I got a gift last year that my wife and I, we didn't need. But my brother and his wife are starting their new family. We were able to repurpose it, give it to them. And every time we see them, they say, oh, we love that gift you gave us. It was so thoughtful. And, I was just going to return it. And instead, we repurposed it for a gift for them.
Now, did you tell them that, to use your word, you repurposed it? Or do they think you bought it explicitly for them?
No, of course not. We told them, we didn't lie. We didn't say we bought it. We just said we got them a gift.
What was it exactly? What did you say that already? What was it?
It was a 3-part crock pot that did sauces and stuff. I live in a small apartment in Fenway. I mean, the thing was bigger than my countertop.
Can I tell you, I'm the biggest crock pot fan on the planet. So you're singing my song there, Dan. My apologies.
I should have given it to you.
Dan,
yeah,
thanks.
I thought you were going to say you gave them
thanks
a baby gift
for the call.
Because that's another thing, you can get a little slippery situation.
There's
all these secondhand kids stores, you know, where they have not only secondhand clothing, especially for newborns.
Well, that's not re-gifting. You just bought somebody a used thing.
That's right, but that's also can get into kind of
dicey territory.
Dicey territory, or used toys, you know, that you buy at the secondhand store that people often do when they're a little pressed for cash, Jim, you know what I'm saying?
See, I am not, for the most part, a re-gifter, and I know Marjorie treasures the gifts I've given her through the years. Several years, she's been talking for about 8 years that I had the audacity to give her high red wool socks about 10 years
That's
ago.
That's right, you gave me some socks.
Why did you consider, I mean, you don't like the cold. They were very high quality wool. Why did you, and they were new, by the way. They're not re-gifted.
I don't know.
What was the problem
with
that?
It's like the year I gave my mother a waste basket for Christmas.
That's what I'm giving you this year, actually.
Socks.
Unbelievable.
Waste basket. Certain things just don't, you know, they just don't work that well.
Actually,
you know
give
mean?
It back to me.
But you
I'll
did give
it
me a lovely gift certificate to a Chinese restaurant.
I did,
last year.
Which you've lost.
No, I haven't.
Have you used it?
No, I've not used it yet.
Okay, fine.
I am not
Joe in New Hampshire, you are next on Boston Public Radio. What do you think of re-gifting or repurposing, Joe? Hi.
How are you?
How are you?
Merino wool socks. Love them.
I think that's what they may have been, actually.
Oh, they are the best.
Oh, unbelievable, yeah.
Re-gifting, it's the greatest thing that ever happened.
Now, why is that, Joe?
I love re-gifting. Because it's just like, you really got to think about, all right, do I want this or don't I? You can tell the person it's a great gift. But is it just going to – I mean, I still have gifts that are sitting in my corner, in my house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've unwrapped, but am I going to use it? Do I really want it? And shouldn't I give it to someone that may want to use it?
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful sentiment, Joe.
And I'm going to save some money.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell everybody that I have to work on Thursday so I can celebrate Christmas with them on Sunday – so I can go after shop and save some money there.
Ay-yi-yi.
Oh, yeah. This is a good one. You can
after
really
shop. That's
make
what the term
a killing
is.
In
That's
the
right.
sales. That's right. Everything's half price.
Joe, you're a strategic man if there ever was one. Thank you for the call, Joe. We appreciate it.
You know, there's a woman in this story who actually has a re-gift closet in which she deposits all the gifts that she's going to save and re-gift for everybody the next year. I think that's a clever one that you can look forward to starting for yourself if you've got the room. Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking about the etiquette of re-gifting and some tips, I mean, that you do have to be careful about if you're going to re-gift so you don't end up giving the sweater that you hated back to the person that...
Did you read this? Well, there was a great story here. This woman gets a hand-knit sweater from
hand
a friend.
Knit.
She doesn't like the sweater. This
Hates
is a New
it.
York Times story. So she decides to give it to somebody else, which is a great idea. If you have been hand-knit is a fairly
expensive
proposition.
With Santa Clauses and little elves on
right.
it and stuff like that.
Now, here's
sweater.
The problem. The problem turned out to be the following. That number one, the woman to whom she re-gifted the sweater was the cousin of the person who had given it to her, but that wasn't the biggest problem. What was the biggest problem? The woman had actually knit the sweater for the cousin who gave it to the woman who gave it back to the knitter.
Yeah, devastating.
It's really
like
devastating.
Giving something to someone with a monogram and it's the wrong person's
it's
monogram,
really
not noticing that it was monogrammed.
I know what you mean. 877-301-8970. We're exploring the phenomenon of regifting. I actually like the term that gentleman used a minute ago, Dan, I think it was, repurposing.
Yeah.
So we're discussing whatever you choose to call
You're very clever. You're very clever about gifts, I must say, Jim.
Thank you. I appreciate
You're
it.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Mike from South Carolina. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, folks. How's it going?
Good.
Very
we're
well.
Good. Thank you.
Good. So I'm taking a very pragmatic approach to this. When I was married, my wife and I, we used to regift when appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And the basic thought was, you know, if we got something that we liked and loved, we didn't open it and use it and, get it mixed up with, the kids' drool on the
Hey, Mike, we got to put you on hold 1 second because the connection got horrible. Don't go away. We'll take a call. We'll go right back to you. So, Mike, hang on for just 1 second, if you would. Put him on hold. Bruce, you're in Marblehead. You're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Bruce.
Welcome. Great show, as always.
Thank you.
First point, Marjorie, don't dish scented soaps. They're a wonderful gift. I love getting them. I love giving them. Nice to put in the drawer.
Yeah.
Nice to just do something unusual instead of the cheapo special at the supermarket.
Okay, so you put them in your drawer to make your socks and underwear smell good?
also to make me feel good when I open the drawer.
Oh, okay. Well, that's nice. All right, that's a nice idea. I'm sorry.
So don't look down your nose at scented soaps.
Okay, I'll take a new attitude.
Bruce, second point, yes.
Second point.
Yes, okay.
Everybody in this society has too much stuff.
That is totally true.
If you receive things that are either meaningless or useless, you look at the intention, you say, how nice of X to give this to me, and you then pass it along to someone with the words, I hope you can find a use for this or you like it, but if not, please pass it along and consider that I thought of you and wanted to give you something.
That's a very nice sentiment.
Who cares where it came from? Everybody's got too much stuff.
Since you're an eloquent advocate for regifting, can I ask you what size your feet are? Bruce, what size are your feet?
10 and a half medium.
Well, actually, perfect, because Marjorie has some red wool socks that she'll be... Bruce, thank you much for the call and the sentiment.
My feet are big, but they're not that big, Jim.
Okay,
not quite.
It was sort of a joke.
I'm sensitive about the size of my feet, Jim.
Let's go to Hopkinton. Anne is on. By the way, that gentleman from South Carolina hung up. We didn't ignore him.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hi. I have a funny story about regifting.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I gave a friend of mine, her husband was retiring, and I bought him a very expensive bottle of scotch. And about a year later, I was with my friend, and we were talking, and I said, I've got to go, it was the day before Father's Day. I said, I got to go get my father something for Father's Day. She said, oh, so do I. I don't have any time. Oh, I'll just give him that. Somebody gave my husband this really expensive bottle of scotch. I'll just give him that.
So, well, that's not so hard. So it went to a good use. Is that the point?
It went to a good use, but I was the one who gave her the bottle.
Were you hurt by that?
She was the one who gave him the bottle.
Yes, she said that.
Oh,
I know that.
I know. I just laughed. I said, yeah, I was the one that gave him the scotch. And she got so embarrassed. But she said to me, the card got separated from the bottle of scotch.
Yeah.
It went to a good purpose. Obviously, her husband didn't like it, so somebody liked it.
By the way, Anne, thank you for the call. One of the pieces of advice from this woman who wrote this great regifting thing in the New York Times, you have to label. That would have solved your problem with your friend Jan.
Correct.
You have to label all the gifts you get as to the giver, so you know to whom you can re-gift should you choose to do it. Our number is 877-301-8970. We're talking about re-gifting, which is actually an annual tradition, the discussion at least, on our show.
But here's the problem with labeling, Jim. That
What's
assumes
it?
A certain amount of organization
mm-hmm.
that people who often end up regifting don't possess. You know what I mean? They're
regifting
because somebody shows up. They hadn't thought, oh, my goodness, that person's going to show up with a gift, so they have to have something upstairs to get them really quickly. That's why you have to go to a place where you can get all this kind of stuff, a bunch of scented soaps on the cheap. You know what I mean? So you'll have them ready just in case somebody...
You can go. Let me tell you something. You go to the Christmas tree shop. You can buy 400 or 500 boxes of scented soaps, and you're basically set up for a decade or maybe even more.
Christmas tree shop. You can't beat it.
I'll tell you, the Christmas tree shop around Christmas is one I've found to be one of the more relaxing experiences. You go there, it's easy to park.
You know what?
That many people in the store.
I used to buy all my furniture there.
Is that really true?
Thank God I'm not
is
doing
that, really
that
true?
Anymore. Yes, because really? It was really cheap. And, of course, it fell apart really fast.
Let's take
Quincy
one or two
from
more, yeah.
Westford. Hi, Quincy.
Kinsey,
I'm sorry.
Hi, Kinsey.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Excellent. Great. Thanks for the call.
I'm a huge fan of regifting. I think, like many other callers have said, that it's a good use of something that maybe you can't use but somebody else might like. But mm-hmm. I think that my mother has come up with an idea that takes it to the next level.
What's that?
Which is when we gather as a family at her house, she will have us draw names. And then since she's been collecting all of our belongings for years, we run around the house and dig through boxes and find things from our past to re-gift to our siblings. And then our siblings are stuck with this weird relic from our childhood, and it's really fun and really entertaining.
Okay. Actually, it
like
does
what?
Sound like it's really
Give
fun.
Give us an example, Kinsey.
Like what, yeah.
Okay, so I've had this, what do you call it, those big ceramic things that you put, like, cider or something in with a stout. I found one of those in a closet and made my brother travel
great.
From Texas to California with it. We found some old walkie-talkies that somebody ended up with. Not me, I'm not that lucky. Some old comic books.
Pretty good.
Some things from our past. Yeah, kid things usually. Sometimes, you know, my mom kind of gives us free reign of the house. And then we just have to check with her before we gift it to make sure it's not.
But you know what the great part about this, and I can't tell if you're being sarcastic about how much you like it. There's a story attached to every one of these things, right? So you not only give the old thing to your sibling, but you tell the story too, no or no?
Yeah, yeah, we get to tell. Yeah, it just brings up memories from our past. And, you know, for my mom, it gets some of our old stuff out of our house, and now we get to enjoy it in a new way.
That's so beautiful.
It has multi-purpose, you know, serves a lot of purposes, for sure.
That's great. Kinsey, thank you for your creative suggestion. We appreciate it.
No, I think I'm inspired, Jim. I think maybe some – maybe the shoe you'd like the bit
red wool socks. Yeah, they'll fit me, I think,
okay,
quite well.
Coming up, can you make a connection from Dungeons & Dragons to rock and roll and religion? If not, we'll be joined by three men who can. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Can rock and roll be a religion? Can the Dungeon Master's Guide be a holy text? We put these questions to Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price earlier this week and all revved up. They were stumped. But the good news is there are three men with us in studio who can take on these questions, or so they say. We're joined by Chris Robichaux. Chris is the editor of Dungeons and Dragons and Philosophy. Chris, how are you?
Hello.
Peter Biebergall is the author of Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. Hello there, Peter.
Thanks. How you doing?
And Ethan Gilsdorf is back. He is the author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. Gentlemen, good to see all three of you.
Thanks for having us back, or having me back. Great
well,
to
we're
be
thrilled
here.
To have you.
We are thrilled to have you. And, okay, so let's start with this premise here that rock and roll can be religion, Dungeons Master's Guide could be a holy text. Anybody want to weigh in on how the Dungeons and Master's Guide can be a holy text?
Take it away. Well, they're all pointing to each other.
Well, I think
and we have Chris.
It's a tough way. A little traffic control.
This is
here.
Ethan, by the way. Go ahead, Ethan.
This is Ethan.
Well, I feel like as a fan of fantasy and role playing games, there's a way in which these experiences, and Peter will certainly speak to the rock and roll side of this, where for those of us who may not have grown up in a traditional household with traditional ideas of how to form our sense of the world, that pop culture can fill that gap. And I think, you know, rock and roll and a game like Dungeons and Dragons, which is so full of, you know, very specific information and ideas about how to live your life and sort of secret knowledge can be a kind of way to, you know, basically be a guide for you.
So you think there's like a deeper message in all this than those of us who just live life on the surface. Is that where you're going, Ethan, with this?
Absolutely. And I also think that, you know, you have a kind of opportunity to interact with these pop cultural phenomenon that doesn't have to be – you can just enjoy them for what they are. Or in the case – I mean, I think probably this is a good thing for you to talk about, Peter, because you have, you know, all of this in your book about how the occult message in rock and roll sort of served as a kind of way for so many people to form their identities.
Right, or the perception of an occult message, which – I mean, so, you know, D&D came of age at a time when – rock had really constructed a mythos around itself, and people, many young people, went to rock not only in terms of the lyrics, but the album covers, the way in which musicians would perform as maybe an opportunity to seek some secret, like Ethan said, some kind of secret knowledge. And it often involved, you know, poring over the album covers, looking for clues to that Paul was dead, or on the Led Zeppelin 3, they had carved Aleister Crowley, who was a turn-of-the-century mm-hmm. magician, on the inner groove, you know, a message from him. So there was a sense that rock both embraced its own mythology in this way, but it also made sort of a community of young people who saw an opportunity here To find this other level of meaning.
Well, which, before we get to the level of meaning, Season of the Witch, obviously, I assume the name of your book follows the great Donovan song. So I spent years just singing the song.
Sure.
What was I missing? Apparently, I was missing a lot, yes? I'm serious. What was he talking about?
Well, I mean, I think, was talking about what a lot of people were talking about then, which was, you know, even though we have these sort of high ideals of hippiedom, of this sort of change in popular consciousness, that there was still always this undercurrent of something dark along the way. And I think that both the light and the dark were made manifest in popular culture by both an increase in an interest in Eastern mysticism. And on the darker side, we start to see by the end of the 60s an increase in an interest in things like the devil and Satan in popular culture. And so pop culture reflects sort of the mood that rock and roll takes us to. And I think popular culture also responded to D&D in precisely the same ways. I think all of us, one time or another, had encountered something around the satanic panic. Maybe, Chris, you could talk a little bit
about that. Well, before Chris does that, before Chris wants to, since you mentioned Season of the Witch, can I play a little piece of this?
Yes,
and then
please,
I want you to tell me what I was missing. Is that okay?
Yes.
Here's a little bit of Donovan, Season of the Witch.
Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch. Yeah. Must be the season of the witch.
Now, I just have to say, Peter, all I assumed Donovan was saying was that I had to pick up every stitch. I figured that's what he was just.
Yes. It is a very good question, and I think it gets to something really essential, mainly the point that I want to make in the book Season of the Witch, is that when rock was carving out a language for itself, particularly for how it understood its relationship to culture, to rebellion, to defiance, it used the language of the occult and esotericism as a means by which to get that up, because those words and those symbols are a very quick way of alerting your audience that you are dangerous or that you are speaking about something that is going to be pushing up against the mainstream. The mainstream is by necessity often equal to traditional religious ideas about the world.
Okay, so let's bring Chris Robichaud in. He's the editor of Dungeons and Dragons and Philosophy. What do you want to add to this, Chris?
Well, we wanted to talk about the satanic panic because everyone's here's eyes lit up when that was mentioned.
It did, yeah. Tell us about it.
So for me, my experience was I played Dungeons & Dragons. I was born in the 70s. I started playing it in the 80s. And during this time, Dungeons & Dragons became very, very popular. It was even – a version of it was even featured in E.T. There's a scene earlier on.
Is that so?
Yeah, where Elliot, the older – is it Elliot? The older brother is playing D&D with his friends or a version of Dungeons & Dragons.
Uh-huh.
So it was really, really popular. Saturday
remember
morning
cartoon.
Remember
they were doing cartoon. It around the Christmas – around the kitchen table?
Exactly.
That's
right.
Oh,
exactly.
I remember that scene.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, a Saturday morning cartoon shows up in E.T. Everyone's playing it. And then there was a scare. It was suggested that Dungeons & Dragons led to darkness, led to devil worship, led to suicide, drug addiction, these sorts of things.
Listening to heavy metal.
Exactly. Same thing. You'll notice a parallel here. Exactly.
There was a murder.
Parallel.
There was a murder in Raynham State Forest. I remember covering it like a long time ago.
It was
25,
in the
30 years ago.
Hanks stars in a movie. I forget what it's called.
Mazes and Monsters. Yeah.
Mazes and Monsters, where it leads to. So, and for me, it really hit home. I grew up in a small town in Ohio. I mean, population 5,000, and there was a town hall meeting when, you know, a police officer and a bunch of other people stood up there and gave testimony to the fact that Dungeons & Dragons led to darkness and all these superpowers. And I remember turning to my mother and sort of saying, what am I doing wrong with this game? Because I want those superpowers. Instead, I'm just sitting around with a bunch of fellow geeks eating pizza and drinking Mountain Dew. So I guess I guess I never quite understood.
What? Nothing has changed, what? Right?
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
You know, Chris, why Mountain Dew? I get the pizza. Why the Mountain Dew?
I think it's a requirement. Somewhere in the Dungeon Master's Guide, I think it says you must drink Mountain Dew. I don't know.
But wait a second. You're not saying this. By the way, I'm not suggesting that listening to the music or playing the game is causing all this satanic-related behavior. But there are some. I mean, are there not some? I mean, the music is what I'm much more familiar with.
Yes.
There are satanic themes in some of these classic songs, are they not?
Sure, although most of the time, if you think about a band like Black Sabbath, who are often accused of being devil worshippers, in fact, their music is, their lyrics are particularly moralistic. They have a wonderful song called The Wizard, in which you think that they're going to be talking about somebody conjuring demons, but actually what this wizard is doing is ridding the world of demons.
Well, we'll be the judge of that. Here is a little bit from Black Sabbath's The Wizard. It's from their first album, which was released in 1975. Here it is. I think Tom Rush wrote that, didn't he, if I recall correctly?
Wait, is he the one that was eating the pigeons, or was that Ozzy Osbourne that was eating the pigeons?
He was also eating pigeons.
Yeah, he was eating pigeons.
Or a bat head, but he thought it was a rubber bat.
Yeah,
and,
it was a rubber bat.
Yes. Well, no, it was real, but he thought it was rubber. You know, the story changes depending on how old he is when he's telling it and how much he wants to shock people.
Okay. Yeah. So, but that, I would imagine that helped them sell records. I mean,
absolutely.
Right?
It's a very smart marketing thing to be able to do. But I also think that it gets to something which is essential both to all of this, which is in the end, rock and roll, like D&D, is about role playing. It's about this performance. It's about having this interaction where both you, say the dungeon master or the musician and the audience or the players, agree at that moment that they are going to be playing roles and they're going to allow themselves to become enamored with this fantasy world.
Well, Ethan, it would seem to me if you're a kid or even if you're a grown-up, you know, the ideas of, you know, devils and cults and all these things is much more appealing than sort of the Beatles going to meet the Maharishi, Mahesh Yogi,
sure,
to learn TM. That's not nearly so exciting, is it?
At least for people of my generation it was, or the kind of kid that I was who was, I think, felt like the world was a fairly mundane place. And I think that, you know, one of the interesting misconceptions about all of this, whether it's rock or whether it's D&D or some of this other fringe culture, is the idea that somehow just because the content of the thing you're playing or listening to has something to do with the occult, that somehow means that you are participating in an occult activity or actually worshiping the devil. You know, one of the key rule books in this game, Dungeons and Dragons, is a thing called the Monster Manual, which basically is like an encyclopedia of all the cool stuff you might encounter in a game and sort of what their properties are. And sure, it's full of elves and trolls, but also devils and demons. And so the very reactionary, you know, parent and religious groups say, oh, no, you know, this book has demons in it. Somehow, just by reading about a demon, you're going to become corrupted. It's actually what was happening in the games is we're fighting those demons. Like, we're on the side of good. We're out to, you know, so in this role-playing experience, we are having, much like the Black Sabbath song here, we're getting an opportunity to be that wizard who is defeating evil, as Ozzy Osbourne talks about here.
How much Mountain Dew do you drink, Ethan? That's what I want to know.
You know, ever since I discovered, you know, espresso, Mountain Dew is not a bigger part of my diet anymore.
You know, Chris Robichaud, you were over at Harvard. There was a big brouhaha when there was going to be that black mass.
Not so long ago.
At Harvard, and I know Catholics were upset about it, but people
didn't they cancel it eventually?
They eventually canceled it, but it seemed to be a sort of hysterical scene over there, and I wonder if it's related to this whole thing about the, you know, the very rigid people being, they never did it, but I thought it would have been fascinating to see, although I know that's a bad thing to say if you're a Catholic.
Well, I was I was smack dab in the middle of that.
You were?
I was.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School.
Yes.
I teach political philosophy. I also teach at the Harvard Extension School. It was a Harvard Extension School club that wanted to reenact this,
right,
and they reached out to me to give an 10-minute talk at the beginning of it about the value of free speech in a well-functioning democracy. And so I agreed to give a 10-minute speech about, you know, free speech. And then everything blew up, as you mentioned. And I found myself in the heart of that as well. I have lots of thoughts of that. Some of them I've put online.
Are you tenured?
I'm not.
That's too bad. Okay, well,
but Chris, how did the goat's blood taste? That's what I want to know.
Yeah.
I think that things have calmed down then, and there's been some very rewarding conversations that have happened both at Harvard Divinity School and Harvard Kennedy School and so forth around that.
So was the takeaway that there was a mistake made by shutting down the Black Mass or not?
Well, technically speaking, it wasn't shut down. It was the organizers, as I understood it, decided of their own to move it off-site. Eventually, it ended up at the Hong Kong in Harvard Square.
Oh, that's
Square.
Right, the Chinese restaurant in Harvard
well.
Square.
If you end the night at the Hong Kong, then that's always a bad sign, in my opinion. But they did voluntarily do that.
You know, if I may for a second, getting back to the music side of this, Peter Biebergall, I want to play one of my favorite Rolling Stones songs by far that I have no idea what it means, but I'm assuming you do. This is Sympathy for the Devil, obviously one of their classics. It's from one of these years, are unbelievable. 1968, it was on Beggar's Banquet. Let's just hear a little of this if we can.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul of faith. I was around when Jesus Christ had his moment of doubt and pain. Made damn sure the pilot washed his hands and sealed his face. Pleased to meet you. Hope you guessed my name. But what's puzzling you is the nature of my game.
Was there a furor around that song when it came out?
Yeah, and he liked that Fuhrer.
Jagger.
Yes, and I think that was part of it. I don't think he believed or worshipped the devil in any way, but he certainly loved that he could present himself as kind of a Mephistophelian, dandy-ish figure. But it was more like sort of the poet that he loved, Baudelaire, who, you know, sort of saw Lucifer as this tragic figure rather than, you know, the Antichrist. And that's also a very important part of how this all gets played out, that it's less about actual worship, like Ethan was saying, and more about image and more about perception. And
what do you mean by that? Say that again. What do you mean by that? That it's more about – say that again.
So it's more about – again, it's sort of about – in magic, in actual, you know, practice of magic, people call it a glamour. It's where you're actually changing the clothing of something so it appears as something else, but it's just an illusion. So Jagger, as this kind of Luciferian figure, isn't that he actually worshipped the devil, but that he could have this sort of representative outfit, which was very attractive, and he knew sort of could play up his own feelings of having power and having will over screaming girls and even how he made the moral majority feel, right? So that's – there's power in both those sides.
Thank you for that, Peter.
Oh, okay. So we need to take a new look at this whole thing. It's what we really need to do. Is that correct? We got to start playing Dungeons & Dragons, you and I, Jim.
Maybe we do.
I'll organize a game whenever you want.
Absolutely.
I knew you would, actually.
I'll bring the Mountain Dew.
I figured you'd bring that, too.
Chris Robichaud, who was in the middle of the whole Black Mass countertop over there at Harvard University, is the editor of Dungeons & Dragons and Philosophy. Peter Biebergall is the author of Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. And Ethan Gilsdorf is the author of Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks. Thank you all so much
good
for coming with
us
today.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow for an interview with Mark Leibovich, a fantastic journalist, reports all about the Washington political scene, New York political scene. Our Friday news quiz with Peter Yarrow and Paul Stuckey. Our show is
as in Peter, Paul, and Mary, for those
Peter,
who don't know
Paul
their last
Mary.
Name.
Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murray, Will Rose, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and John Parker. I'm Marjorie Egan.
See you tomorrow.